Hey everyone. It's Radio Free Nintendo episode 450, and I'm your host, James Jones. We made
Yay!
It.
Yay!
Spoilers. We made it. With me today, Mr. John Lindemann.
Unfortunately, I couldn't get 50 Cent for this particular episode, but
you sure? I think that's actually I think it's actually his going rate.
Too
at this
busy
point,
doing escape plan 2 or whatever.
Jesus. Also with me today, Mr. Greg Leahy.
Oh, hey, everyone.
Also with me today, and I'm actually going to introduce him before I say anything because he'll get mad if I don't, Mr. Guillaume Vaillette.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Guillaume. Thank you for not throwing a temper tantrum this week. Also with us today. Because he hosted most of the episodes between 400 and 450, so it really just seems appropriate. Dr. Jonathan Metz.
Now, I just want to make it clear, I'm resigning, not retiring.
You're retiring.
Yeah, that's a Spurrier joke. I don't know how many people are going to get that. But
or also
hi.
A Don Mattingly joke as well.
If you could replace Lou Holtz, that's fine.
You did quit on the team midseason.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I suppose I did, but I have really enjoyed the show since I left. I enjoy it much more than before I left.
You're welcome.
It's more fun for me. But no, you guys are doing a great job, and I'm excited to be back for this special episode, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're glad that we can make this work out and that now we've got this really deep representation of like 370 episodes of the show following last week's brief return. Of Mr. Movie Phone himself.
that was really awesome that Stan did that. I thought that was incredible. yeah, but also I want to say, Greg, it's been a very long time since I talked to you on a podcast. So hi,
hello.
Greg.
It's been about a year since the last telethon, isn't it?
Been a good while. Thank you for filling in for me.
Yep, I try my best.
It's been very enjoyable for me to hear you talk about this stuff every week.
Thank you very much.
So now you put him on the spot.
So
John.
Uncomfortable,
thanks.
Man.
Yep.
So James, man. What are we doing for 450, boss?
Actually, because we went way over the moon on 400. We went nuts. We did. I mean, it was great.
We were texting the other night. Like, it's been over a year now since that happened. But man, what a crazy thing that was.
That was weird and crazy. And at some point, John and I played George the Jungle in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Yep.
On the internet.
Is that a euphemism?
No, it's not.
In a recording studio.
We were
literally,
studio.
Figuratively, and spiritually.
I will say the best part about that, John, is we actually may have played that game longer than the related TV show reboot was on the air. So
we probably played it longer than the QA testers that actually were assigned to that game. So
clearly,
I think my favorite part of that weekend was when we finished up the actual episode recording at the studio, and the young lady who was our engineer. I said, so what'd you think or something like that? A really dumb thing to ask. And she said, well, you guys sure seem to know what you're talking about. I'm sure she was bored to tears the whole 3 hours or however long we were in there, but
we were in there a while, but she was getting paid. So whatever.
Right. She definitely got paid. I'll say that. Places not cheap.
For me, one of the highlights was us wandering around a convenience store trying to psych ourselves up for the recording, discussing what bum wine we should require.
Yeah. Always.
Because there were some good ones. There were some good choices.
Oh, yeah.
Some regional favorites.
Mm-hmm.
But we ended up foregoing that, and we went in there sober, which...
Terrible idea.
Decisions were made, and we have to live with them from this point forward. But...
I have regrets.
This week, this anniversary, this 10 divisible, 50 divisible number episode...
Sober no more.
We're going to keep it a little chill. We're actually going to run it with new business, just like normal. And we're going to go into not playing for some regrettable reason. And then we're going to have a feature conversation about the NX and some other topics, depending on how time looks. Because with five people, things can run a little long and we don't necessarily know yet. But now, it's time for new business. And as our guest, Dr. Metz, you've got a lot of video gaming done in your time away from the show.
I have.
But
yes.
I'm going to ask you to keep that under control.
So I'm on World 3 of Yoshi's Woolly World. I haven't been playing it every day since it came out about a week ago, but I played it a good bit over the weekend, and I really like it. I was, you know, really looking forward to it. I thought it demoed really well at E3 the past 2 years, and I was kind of annoyed that we had to wait so long to get it, but I'm glad it's finally out now. I should say I was able to get two of the amiibo for my niece and nephew. I got a blue and a pink one. But anyway, the game is really good. You know, I'm not the biggest Yoshi fan or even the biggest Yoshi's Island fan, but I am a really big fan of Good Feel, and I love Wario Land Shake It, and I really liked Kirby's Epic Yarn, but I definitely, you know, kind of fell. I'm sure there's multiple episodes of me and the rest of you guys talking about it from a long time ago, but, you know, I definitely fell on the side of, well, it's kind of too easy, and that some can sometimes make it feel a little bit boring or even sort of tedious to play through, but, you know, the visual presentation, the wonderful soundtrack, you know, the kind of fresh, you never quite knew how the game was going to be played because it was hard to tell sometimes, you know, what the inner environment would do when you interacted with it because of it's made of all these crazy materials. And Yoshi definitely carries those things through, but it's still very accessible. And I think this would be a great game to play with like younger kids or a family member or someone who doesn't play games as much. But, the way that they have sort of enabled that is with, you know, this mellow mode, which you can choose or you can certainly not choose, in my case, you know, that makes you more invincible and I think gives Yoshi wings. So it makes it much less likely that you would fall in a pit or something like that. I haven't really messed around with it, but that's nice that that's there for people who would want to do it. And then there's also a system of badges where you can sort of apply a power up to yourself before you go into a level. And there's a lot of different ones. They cost gems, but the gems are fairly plentiful. And some of these things are pretty, pretty cheap. So you could conceivably use them pretty often. I've only messed around with them just once or twice. There was a lava level, where I used this badge that made me immune to lava, and it made that level incredibly easy. So it's kind of something that I don't really want to mess around with too often just because I'm afraid it might make me appreciate the level design less, but it's nice that it's there and it certainly could be helpful for some people, or it's very situational. But you know, I like that they're handling it this way rather than just make the entire game super easy and just no stakes at all like they did with Kirby's Epic Yarn, because Yoshi's Woolly World feels more like the levels do have some challenge built into them. There's some platforming that is actually pretty tricky, especially if you're going for some of the collectibles, you know, some of which are just in plain sight, but in order to get them, you really have to take a big risk. Yoshi, you know, can hover sort of laterally almost as much as you want because he does a flutter jump and then you can immediately start another one. And if you time it right, you can sort of do it indefinitely without really losing much altitude. But once you fall down even a little bit, you're not going to be able to get back up any higher than that. So if you miss the timing, or if things are attacking you, or if you just kind of screw up the jump in the first place, it's not totally, you know, get out free. So I've died a few times, even up through the third world. Maybe that means I'm a bad gamer, but I think some of these levels have some tricky parts, even early in the game, and I know that they get harder.
The thing about this game, of course, is there are no lives, so
right,
it's not like
right.
It's a huge deal when you die. You just go back to the last checkpoint, and it's very the thing I like is just how brisk it is. It's just no messing around, just get straight back to
right.
The last checkpoint, and you get back on your way. It doesn't make a big deal of it.
Right. You do have to recollect anything that you got before you died since the checkpoint. So, you know, it can be, you feel like, man, I don't want to die again. You know, like I'm going around and collecting all this stuff and finding these secrets for the second time. I definitely don't want to have to do it a third. In some cases, I've had to do it a third. So I'd say the game does have some challenge built into it, even though, you know, it certainly is smoothed over a lot of the rough edges. The one thing I actually kind of wish they'd gone a little further on is just, I wish you had unlimited eggs. Because
I think there's an argument for it at this point, you know, to be honest, because sometimes it just kind of feels like this vestigial thing that's there from the original game where, mm-hmm. you know, you kind of, we find yourself maybe having to just go back somewhere and, you know, find some enemies or a pipe that's shooting out some enemies to replenish your egg stock or that kind of, and it's just, well, you know, it's not particularly challenging to do that.
Yeah, so. And it takes a while, or most of the time when there is something that requires eggs, they've got this box that you know, you hit, then it gives you eggs.
It's yeah, like, what's the point? They're quite liberal with that. I mean, the only thing I would say is there's a few cases, maybe like in the very trickiest stages where, you know, if you're going to get a secret, it's incumbent on you to hit it the first time, or maybe as quickly as possible before it disappears or something like that. Mm. So in that case, you know, the scarcity of eggs kind of matters, but you know, like I said, it's more about the time involved than it is the number. I mean, I guess it is easier if you could spam them really fast, but you know, I still don't think it would take the challenge away from those circumstances.
Well, I mean, they could
always
just,
unlimited eggs.
They could always just put a cooldown on it too, so
right.
You can't just
especially if it like goes beyond the 6 eggs or something, you know, just then maybe another egg takes a little while to regenerate or something, but not too long, you know. But I agree broadly.
Yeah, I mean, it would change the game quite a bit, but the more I play it, the more I feel like, you know, the act of sort of managing your inventory of eggs doesn't add very much. It occasionally can be frustrating if if you're going for a certain secret or something like that, and you happen to use up all of your eggs to do it, and then you get inside of a door in like a bonus stage area, and now the thing that you do there to try to get the sunflower or whatever it is you're looking for also requires eggs, and you've already used all of them just to even get there. And there's nothing you can do about it except look at it and say, well, I'm fucked, and just leave.
Because that's the kind of the big distinction. The sunflowers, you know, will be oftentimes the trickiest ones will be ones that you shoot with eggs, whereas like the balls of yarn that you get that give you the Yoshi skins, they you have to actually touch physically
right.
to get them.
You can't just shoot eggs at those. So, I feel like you could still get some benefit out of eating enemies. Maybe they would give you gems, or maybe they would give you a more powerful egg, or you know, get the big balls of yarn. I mean, eggs, yarn, it's all the same thing in this game, but you get the big balls sometimes, and they bounce around and they're more powerful and they blast through certain kinds of blocks. I think those would be a good reward for eating an enemy versus, you know, just using an egg that you always have with you. Whereas right now it seems like they're mostly kind of random when you get those. And then, you know, Guillaume mentioned the egg block, and they are fairly liberally placed around, but it takes about 15 seconds to just kind of, you know, tediously jump up and down like 6 or 7 times to make all the yarn come out of there. I feel like just hit it once and max me out. You know, or whatever. Yeah. There's just a lot of little things like that.
There was a thing in Yoshi's Island where, you know, that those plants that spit the eggs out. And if you did a bottom bounce next to it, it would actually spit them out faster. You know, so it's like they were aware of that even back then. Mm. You know, that kind of issue of standing there waiting around. But it's not a big deal. But again, like just any of these little frictions would be good to take out. But I think I think a lot of it is vestigial. It's just, I mean, if you play the game through to the end, you know, there's lots of cases where they're kind of sticking pretty close to the Yoshi's Island playbook. Obviously not as sort of slavishly and unimaginatively as Yoshi's New Island, but it's very much a Yoshi's Island game.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And it really does feel like that, which I think for the most part is a good thing. I guess the only reason I harp on this a little bit is that as I'm playing through the game, I'm never quite sure whether egg management is a thing or not. Because sometimes I feel like I need to be really careful because there's a lot of certain kinds of enemies or certain objects in the level that require eggs to be activated or to be killed. Like you can't stomp on them for some reason, or you can't eat them with your tongue. So you need eggs for certain things, and I'll be really judicious with them. And sometimes I'll run out, but then I'll get to like the next section of the level and suddenly I'm really careful with them. And then I find out that there's just a ton of them all of a sudden. Like I'm never really clear on how careful I should be with the eggs, because if you're really, really careful with them, it can slow down your play a lot. And that may not be what I want out of the game, but if you're really liberal and just kind of sling them all over the place all the time, then you could very easily get in a situation where all of a sudden you can't proceed without having an egg. And therefore you have to like go all the way back, like half, sometimes like half the level backward in some of these levels to go find more eggs just to be able to finish the level. It's just like really weird things like that kind of mess up the pacing.
Usually if you're talking about something that's a core requirement to progress, it won't be that onerous. But if you're talking about getting the secrets, then, you know, it might be. But I think that goes back to something that I found in that because you get credit for things the first time through, you know, you don't have to just collect everything to get credit for anything anymore.
Right.
I had a similar sort of mindset in terms of sometimes I was quite cautious with the eggs, and sometimes I'd make sure not only did I have six trailing me, but I'd have an enemy in my mouth so that I could spit it out and sort of save using an egg.
Yes,
expert player here.
For certain functions that, you know, that would be adequate for. But the fact is, you know, for me, as it went on, it just kind of became clear, look, I'll play the first time through, and yeah, I'm going to try and find stuff, and yeah, I'm going to be sort of generally a bit cautious, but I'm not going to get too OCD about it, because it's very unlikely you're going to find absolutely everything, even if you're being incredibly thorough.
Well, and good kill games are made for the replay.
Yeah, they are, and this is right. Very... So it's just kind of like, I just sort of play through it the first time without being too you know, thorough about it, and then the second time, of course, you just use your working knowledge of the level to kind of grease it and know where you do have to be careful about eggs and where you don't.
Yeah, I'm doing the same thing, although, you know, I'm when I finish a level, I'm not really inclined to immediately go back through it again and get everything I missed. So
no,
I'm
not just... immediately. No, I didn't do it. I'd usually start going back maybe once I'd completed the whole world. And then sprinkle it in with playing the new level. So that's generally, I just sort of, you know, new level, old level, different mixes. You know, that went down well for me.
Yeah.
So as somebody who's not played the game beyond an E3 demo, what's the boss situation like? So that's our measuring stick we use for Mario and Mario related games. how inspired / uninspired are these bosses?
They look amazing. That's one of the things about this game is that because of the art style with all the materials and the yarn and all the fabrics, the larger the characters are on the screen, the more detail you can see. And in HD, sure, they actually look better the bigger they are and the more detailed they are. So like, you know, there's all the transformations that Yoshi can do, and some are more fun than others. But the one that I like the most so far, even though it's super simple, is it just makes Yoshi really big, just like the Mega Yarn Yoshi amiibo. And he just looks way cuter when he fills up the whole screen. I mean, it just, the detail on the character and the animation and everything about it, and the physics of how he moves, and he's all squishy and fluffy. It just looks awesome when he's that big. And the bosses are, you know, just like in Yoshi's Island, they're all basically just Kamek makes a giant version of an enemy that you've already seen. And for the same reason, they look amazing when they're much bigger. But as far as the action of them goes, they kind of follow this pattern of, like, you know, they're basically invulnerable except for like one very brief phase of their attack pattern. And so, you know, you'll go through a few cycles of watching them and to try to figure out where you're supposed to attack. Sometimes you use your tongue, sometimes you have to throw an egg. If you have to throw eggs, then of course they have to create enemies or provide some other way for you to regenerate eggs once you run out. Sometimes you just have to jump on top of their heads or ground pound them. But, you know, they've been pretty simple so far.
Yeah, the big criticism with the bosses, if you've seen reviews, is that the mid bosses, the ones that occupy the fourth level in each world, the fortresses, they kind of repeat. They've got only, I think they've only got like, was it three of them? And then so you'll fight them twice each or something like that. Yeah, and they do change, the battles will change somewhat, you know, the particular environments or the attack patterns. I think they'll be a bit different, but some of them, it seems like they, you know, it does feel even more like going through the motions, you know, because I mean, none of them are like that ridiculously hard or anything, as you might expect from this kind of game.
Well, that's a Mario tradition. That's a Super Mario world.
As long as they're not all tradition. Bowser Jr.,
even Mario
about
games that in general one would consider to be significantly more difficult than a Yoshi game have bosses that are that way.
Right.
So it's not surprising, but there is, as a very, very late sort of unlockable, essentially a turbo mode against the bosses where they just speed them up ridiculously fast. And
nice.
Then, like, they are a hell of a lot more challenging, and the attack windows are really tight, but it kind of makes you as cheap a sort of, it's the little extra thing as it is, I actually quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, cool. So far, I have to say, I am very much enjoying Yoshi's Woolly World, and, you know, I'm playing it alone, but I think it'd be a good two-player game. I've played the demos as two-player. I don't know if I would want to play the whole game that way, but I think it would be fine.
Yeah, well, I've only managed to play the game today, and I got through the first two levels. So of course, it's not really representative of the whole game, but the first two levels, the co-op worked well.
Yeah,
good.
Yeah, like we weren't getting in each other's way too much. And
let me ask the million-dollar question, Guillaume: if I wanted to, could I get in your way?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, you can troll each other.
Yeah, absolutely. You can, you know, eat up the other person and spit them out or make them an egg. And they...
Every day, Guillaume.
Nice. I guess that's the one thing we should say about the whole egg situation is that if there's two of you, you've always got at least one on hand, essentially.
Right. Yeah, that's true. That's true. But it's also, you control the other person. Like, if you eat them up, they lose their eggs. And if they don't get them afterwards, like, after they've managed to escape their egg form, they disappear. So I think there can be bad blood that, you know, as you play this game, like, just...
That's what I want to hear.
Yes.
Do they carry their eggs inside of the egg that you make of them? Are there eggs inside of the eggs?
No. They just, they drop to the ground and they disappear after a while.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
You have to go.
Well, eggs inside of eggs, that would be crazy.
That would be crazy. You know what else is crazy, James, is I beat Grand Theft Auto 5 last night.
I do the transitions here, sir.
Sorry.
Congratulations on your accomplishment.
Hey, it took a long time. I've been playing this game for almost a year, you know, off and on.
Are we talking about this?
just very, 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 very briefly, just to say that
Guillaume does not give an F about you completing this game.
He wants to call me out. That's his purpose.
Yes. I
only bring it up for the purposes of saying, John, you better get on that Skyrim.
Oh, Christ. Here we go.
Yep.
Oh, boy.
Don't forget our pact.
All right.
Rock Band 4, hey, it's Rock Band.
Is it all Rock Band?
It is. Just Rock Band.
It is Rock Band ass Rock Band.
But it's the first time I've had Rock Band in a few years because I lost all my plastic crap in the flood and I didn't have an Xbox after that, so I wasn't able to do anything. So, you know, now that I have an Xbox One, was one of the reasons I got an Xbox was because of Rock Band, so I can play my old songs. And they did add a freestyle guitar solo mode. They did some other stuff, but the only instrument I have is guitar right now. And these freestyle solos are really super fun. I am digging it big time. It really makes you feel like you're actually playing something. You know, there's no notes appearing on the screen for you to try to match up, but it has different patterns that it shows that give you like basically it wants you to play either up high or up low, or it wants you to play long notes, or it wants you to play like super fast, or it'll tell you, hey, do some like finger tapping like Van Halen style. So to give you suggestions, but it doesn't really matter which specific buttons you're hitting as long as you stay in rhythm. And they do a really good job of making that stuff sound good. And usually it sounds like it should belong in the song, you know, like it sort of matches the key and the tone, and the feel of the song, and they do a good job of sort of charting out the rhythm. So I've really enjoyed that. I think it feels really cool. You still get points for it, and you can turn it off if you don't like it, but I like that stuff a lot. So, I like playing solos in Rock Band.
And you know what the best part about Rock Band is? It's that the microtransaction laden Guitar Hero sequel that just came out. So
yeah, Johnny, you play Guitar Hero at E3, right?
Yeah, I loved it. I love Guitar Hero Live.
Compared to this, what do you think?
I mean, Guitar Hero Live is a much different animal. It's a much weirder thing. And at E3, we were like peppering those guys with questions, and some of them they couldn't answer yet. I think they maybe just hadn't decided how some of that stuff's going to work. But you know, the thing with Guitar Hero Live is the controller's different. It's got two rows of three buttons, and so when you're playing the songs, you kind of I kind of had to like go from hard back down to medium, you know, just because I'm relearning these patterns, and it feels very different, but it feels more like playing a real guitar, which I like a lot. And then, and you don't have to move your, you don't have to shift your hand up and down the frets as much. So if you have trouble with that, but you wish that, say, the medium difficulty on Rock Band was more interesting to play and had more combinations possible, then I think the Guitar Hero controller would be better for you. And then the song selection doesn't do a lot for me, but they have that streaming Guitar Hero TV thing, which is just super weird because you'll turn it on and it's like, it has like channels, so they have different styles of songs that you can skip around to, but like you choose the heavy metal channel and it's just whatever song is on at the time, that's what's there. And if you want to play it, you can play it. You might jump in like halfway through the song, and when it's over, it's over, and it moves on. And you don't get to choose what new song it is.
No.
That's yeah. really weird. It's kind of like Pandora, but for Guitar Hero. And, you know, if you like going in there and playing your favorite songs over and over again, or if you like kind of playing a certain style of song, then it might not be for you.
So you can get those songs on the TV with microtransactions.
Yeah, you can choose.
But you can't own them.
Right. You can never own it permanently. I have a feeling that they're going to adjust some of that stuff.
They've got
per
to.
Feedback. And when they do, then I would definitely consider getting it. For yeah, sure, because I think it was super fun, and the presentation was amazing. I was so impressed by it at E3. So
it is a weird experiment.
So do you subscribe to these channels, or what?
No, it's all free.
Okay.
There is no DLC per se, and there is no subscription to play it.
Okay, but what are you actually buying then with the microtransactions?
So here
it's like a jukebox. It's like if you want to hear a specific song at a specific time, then you can put in your 25 cents or whatever they call it. You buy them in packs. You can also earn those just from playing it, but I think you have to play it quite a bit to sort of...
Yeah, it's a hard earn.
Yeah, so it's treated more like a free-to-play game. You can sort of build them up over time without paying anything, but if you're impatient or if you have people over and you just want to play a certain song, then you can pay a modest fee. So I don't love that model, but I think it's interesting. I'm glad they're doing something totally different than Rock Band, because now you actually have, you know, a point of comparison, and you can say, well, this appeals to me more, or that appeals to me more, and they're not trying to do exactly the same thing, and I think that's good.
Cool.
Yeah. So, Guillaume.
Yes.
I have a ghost problem. Can you help me out?
Yes, I can do some extreme exorcism.
Whoa. Is that like just regular exorcism, please?
Oh, no. I've got to go extreme.
It's exorcism while bungee jumping. That's
actually it's exorcism with a shotgun and a grenade launcher and all sorts of other weapons. So
that
extreme...
sounds like it's not covered by my insurance.
Extreme Exorcism is a game that was part of the Nindies at Home promo, so you might have played the demo, and if you did, I think at this point it's too late. I think you had 1 month to buy the game and get a 15% discount. But
that's correct.
I don't exactly like this whole 15% discount thing is not really working for me, because I'm in Canada, and so they've upped the prices on the eShop, and I'm probably paying the same price that I would have if the game had come out earlier, like before our dollar just fell through the floor. So it's this game, kind of this 2D game, single screen arcade action, I suppose, with up to four players, but you can play solo. I was playing co-op with Karen. You are in this mansion, and there are ghosts, and so you spawn somewhere in the level. It's kind of random, and then these weapons appear. So you grab a weapon, and you kill at first the demonic chair. That's not a very tough enemy to defeat. The game kind of starts over, and this time you're trying to dispatch this ghost that's following the path that you took to dispatch the chair. And the ghost is also using whatever weapon you've been using at the moment you've been using it. So basically the game is using the replay of your play to create these ghosts that you have to dispatch. And so things get more and more chaotic, and if you've got several people playing at the same time, then it just gets more chaotic exponentially, right? Like you've got, you know, like the second time that you're playing, you've got three ghosts already on the screen, and they're all trying to kill, you know, the air, or if you happen to be, you know, in their path, then they're going to kill you. So it's kind of interesting, because you can definitely stick to, you know, try to play as conservatively as possible, and use the least the weapons that would have the least amount of like splash damage or like collateral damage. And so, you know, you try to dispatch these ghosts very quickly so that the next turn you're not gonna be facing something that's shooting everywhere and unpredictably. So you can try to do that for a while, but eventually, like, it's just going to get too much, and you might slip, or you might, you know, if you're playing with someone else, you might get dispatched by their ghost, because, you know, you didn't memorize exactly what path they were taking. You were just focused on what you were doing. So it's pretty fun. Mm. But the game seems a little bit perhaps shallow, and I think that the designers knew that, because what they've been doing is they've created a lot of levels with a lot of different themes. So you've got like catacombs and mansions and stuff like that. And you've got several levels with that decor. But you've also got, you're constantly unlocking new weapons. So at first you start and you've got very, you know, standard guns. But eventually, like, throwing knives that you shoot at, you know, on each side of you, which can be useful. But again, when the ghosts are doing it, it's less fun. And eventually, like, I've already unlocked, like, shotguns that, of course, have, like, a wider range of damage. And I've unlocked a grenade launcher, which the grenades don't explode on impact. They explode after a certain time. So when you're using that weapon, you try not to shoot everywhere for no reason, because otherwise you're going to regret it very soon. And
it's a very methodical weapon.
Yeah, yeah. And which is sad, because you've got a grenade launcher. You want to
it's a freaking grenade launcher.
Yeah, exactly. You want to blow everything up, but it's wise not to. And so you can equip up to 3 weapons at a time. The weapons, you know, they appear at random throughout the stage. And when you shoot all 3 of them at the same time. So it's kind of limited, the combinations that you can do. I mean, it's not limited, but it's random. Like, you don't choose exactly which weapons you're going to have. So it's not like you can be, okay, so I'm going to drop mines behind me while I'm throwing knives. And, you know, this is a good combo that works for me. Because you're not, the game is not going to hand you that all the time when you want it, right?
Yeah.
And you unlock these weapons like very quickly. I've unlocked, like, sometimes when you do really well, it's based on the scores that you have. When you do really well, you unlock 2 or 3 at a time. And I think that's kind of the hook that the game tries to use to keep you playing over and over again. And, Karen and I only played maybe like an hour or two, so we're still very early. So the jury's out as to whether this game has longevity, but, we've been enjoying it. And of course, the extreme exorcism part of the game, there is a weapon that basically, it looks like a pair of wings on the screen. So you grab that and you become this angel with kind of a radius, some sort of halo, or I don't know. So when you use that,
an aura,
then you dispatch, yeah, an aura. And when you use that, all the ghosts that come into contact with that aura are dispatched forever. So you try to be strategic with that weapon. You know, you try to place yourself in the path of all these clones of yourself from, you know, from before, and you try to suck up as much as you can, as many as you can, and so they're not going to be a danger to you later on.
Clean stuff up.
Yeah, basically. So it's cool. A cool concept. It's a lot of fun, and you know, it's enjoyable co-op. I'm not sure if it's as much fun when you're playing by yourself. But for a party game, I think that would work really great.
And it supports up to 4 players?
Up to 4 players. None online. It's also on PlayStation 4, but I don't think there's online play for that either. I think it's just local couch co-op.
That could get real dumb, real crazy, real fast. Mm-hmm.
Couch co-op, and there's some other modes that I haven't tried, which I'm sure are less co-op. So I've been playing that, and I've also finished Chibi Robo Ziplash. So
how do you feel about it, Guillaume?
Yeah, well, last week I was not ambivalent. I was pretty positive, you know, but
yeah,
I was saying that it's a decent platformer. Now I realize that in more ways than just the spin wheel, the level select thing, this game deliberately kind of wastes your time. So I still think that kids wouldn't mind, but it does hamper my enjoyment of it. And now that I've finished it, I've unlocked a few things and levels that I can go back to and collect, but I don't feel like it. Like, it's not that interesting.
Guillaume, I'm sad that this game you're waiting for is not what you were hoping.
Well,
like, I feel bad for you, because I know how much you care about this character.
Yeah, well, you know, I it's the character is awesome. And the thing is, like, I don't know, it just seems like the game was poorly thought out in, you know, one too many ways. Like, just, you know, like, there's a few of the problems that the game has, it would have passed. But as it is right now, it's kind of like this game that you play once and then you probably sell off. But you keep the amiibo because you're an asshole. So yeah, like the thing is, like, you've got these characters, right? That these friends that you can, that they appear randomly in the levels in each world.
Like Toby.
You've got like Toby, like, oh, he's in God. The world one. And like then Toby. you've got like other even more cute, friends in later
cuter
worlds.
Than Toby.
Yeah, you've got this penguin that's into fashion. It's
oh
awesome.
My gosh.
But so yeah, so they appear in a random level in the world, and so you go meet them, and then they ask you for candy, the snacks that you've been collecting, right? So they ask you for one, and usually you've got it, like the first one that they ask you for, you usually have it, you have collected it, so you give it to them. But then the second one, you usually don't have it, and then you go a little bit further in the level, and there's no way to backtrack to that, you know, to that portal, to that friend. Mm. And like, it's exactly the candy that they've been asking you. And you're like, oh, well, thanks.
Man,
you know, like,
fuck you, Toby.
Yeah, exactly. And so like, they disappear from that world and then they appear in another level. And it's just, even if you go back and collect everything and then you go and try to feed them this candy, like, they're only going to accept three, and then you have to choose another level and find them again and feed them three candy and then find them again. And it's for no reason, you know, like, often they'll pop up in levels that you've already 100% found everything. And it's just, the game is deliberately wasting your time. They're trying to make it a good value, quote unquote, by giving you a lot of stuff to do that's not terribly interesting.
It reminds me of the friggin' comets in the first Super Mario Galaxy, where they would never be where you needed them to be.
Yeah, well, there's that, and also the fact that there's an animation, like, you get into your ship that's in the shape of your head, and you every time that you go from one world to the other, you see that animation, and if you thought that in Super Mario Galaxy 2 it was annoying, well, you're not going to enjoy this at all, because it just takes way longer, and it's, yeah. So, you know.
Shigeru Ziplash, not as good as Super Mario Galaxy.
No.
Confirmed.
No. But also, I played, you know, the first two levels of Woolly World today, and immediately, like, it's obvious that it's a better platformer to be getting for the holidays. So,
I mean, that's kind of a bummer for me personally, because I have no love for the Chibi Robo character. Mm. But, like, I know so many people, including on this show, that do. Like, I would like to see Nintendo treat it well. I mean, Johnny, yeah. You did the interview, or you were in the interview we did about this game. Did besides you asking them for, because I actually typed it up. Besides you asking for Toby Amiibo. Was there anything that you took away from that interview, kind of as an impression on that game, or from playing it, I guess?
Actually, I don't think I ever really talked about playing it that much on the show, but it was not from the interview. The interview was very kind of like,
PR-y.
It was very PR-ish, because it's a 2D platformer, and it's not a terribly interesting game. But anyway, I thought when I played the E3 demo, I thought the game felt a little clunky, and I didn't like having to stand there on the ground and hold a button for 3 seconds to use the cool attack.
Right.
I felt that should have been the main attack, and you should be able to launch it in midair or just whenever you feel like it. So it didn't really have the immediacy that I kind of look for in 2D platformers. So, I was kind of curious about it. That been, you know, then once I heard about all the crazy level select stuff, I said, I'm good. I'll remember that first Chibi Robo game very fondly and wish that they would make another one like that, even though it probably won't happen. I think it's really unfortunate that the producers of this game have been kind of going around saying, well, we really hope this one sells, because if not, we probably won't get to make any more of them. And it's like,
yeah,
that probably goes without saying, but I feel like they're sort of guilt tripping fans into buying this, and it just doesn't really seem like all that amazing of a game. You know, it's like, I love Chibi Robo. I would buy this game if it sounded like an awesome Chibi Robo game, and it just kind of doesn't.
Yeah, it sounds like a, you know, a decent spinoff of a franchise.
Yeah. I
mean, and it sold like crap in Japan, correct?
Right.
From what I
saw. Sure it did. Sure it did.
Sold like
Chibi Robo is doomed, and it's too bad because there's just sometimes like they stretch the kind of the gameplay that they have a little bit too thin, and sometimes there's like the germ of a good idea but it never really develops. And like one of the coolest things that you can do is against a, you know, like one of the final bosses, and they do it once and then it's never explored again. I'm just like, why? You know, like they've got like this boss kind of sucking you up in the air. And you have to latch on to an enemy and to anchor yourself. And you see, you know, like this great animation of Chibi hanging on to his, plug to his cord and just like being sucked up in the air and trying to, you know, to hang on. But, they do that once, and it could have been, you know, they could have, done more stuff with that. They could have played with gravity a little bit. They could have like spun rooms around, anything, but they didn't.
I feel like we found the producer for the next Chibi Robo game.
Yeah, really. Well, hey, Chibi Robo got 5 games. That's more than a lot of characters can say. And I feel like the best thing that could happen for Chibi Robo right now is to end up in either this Smash Brothers or the next Smash Brothers as a playable character, and introduce a new generation to the character who have never played any of his actual games, and then maybe eventually build up enough, you know, fan passion for him that Nintendo decides to try it again.
That we get a bad third person shooter that comes with the kickstand.
Chibi Robo Federation Force, anybody?
No.
I'm saying. Anyways,
no.
Yeah.
Greg, you have a franchise that's guaranteed to not come back.
Yes, the Konami franchise.
Unless it's going to come back as in pachinko form. Konami is back in pachinko form.
Yeah, so this is Konami Crazy Racers. I'm not comfortable with the word crazy being spelled with a K. I'm not.
it's against your British sensibilities.
Why? Yeah, YY Racing is what it was originally known as in Japan, as it does have the connection to a sort of earlier Konami silly mashup series of games on the Famicom. I think there was 2 of them called YY World that had a bunch of characters together, because they were never localized. But this is the racing game. It's a basic same kind of idea of putting them all together. And
I think YY is a Japanese onomatopoeia for like a sound that crazy people make.
Yeah, it's like so that's how it ended up as Crazy Racers. You know, it's pretty fairly literal. But the title. Sort of menu song of why racing didn't get changed.
We have a budget and we are not going to spend 1 cent more.
Oh, the localization is bare bones. There's some pretty obvious typos and all sorts of stuff in this.
Bobby, welcome to the Game Boy Advance.
To be clear, this is a virtual console game in Europe at the minute. It just came out and on the Wii U, so you know, I didn't get it at the time for the GBA, because it was about 2 months before Super Circuit was going to be coming out, so it was kind of I'll wait for the real deal, you know. Like it got really good reviews, including by a young man named Jonathan Metz, who wrote a review for it on PlanetGameCube.com back in 2001. To quote his review here, he said,
14 years ago,
let's
you beat
get
me to it, Greg.
Let's get this out of the way right now. In terms of game design and play control, Konami Crazy Racers is a complete and utter ripoff of the Mario Kart series, which is, I very much agree. You know, and of course, it's really ripping off Super Mario Kart, you know, because that's, you know, the style of game that the GBA could do, the Super Nintendo Mode 7 style. But whereas Super Circuit, for instance, was trying to kind of marry the two, you know, that you had at that point, Mario Kart 64 and Super Mario Kart, in terms of, you know, some of the power sliding mechanics, the blue shell, you know, this is almost, you know, like a closer rip-off of Super Mario Kart than Super Circuit was. Because it's not so much about, power sliding around corners or that kind of thing. It's, more about using the hop, a lot, that you would have, although there is no feather, sadly. There are no item that rips off the feather.
But let me ask, does Mario Kart let you play as the Moai statue? Or
it does not. No, this is it. I mean,
does it let you race around on an arcade board?
As Gray Fox?
Like the computer motherboard of an arcade machine.
It's I have a big soft spot for silly Konami.
Kart racing.
I love the Goemon games, parodies games. Although I wouldn't recommend giving them to a 5-year-old, I still enjoy them. this sort of silly component of Konami.
You raise your kids, I'll raise mine, Greg.
I only said I wouldn't recommend it. I didn't say I would prohibit it in some way or report it to child services or something. But anyway, I do really like the silly Konami, but they've been dead even longer than the rest of it. I think the last time they did something similar to this was that sort of post Mario and Sonic track and field game that had Chibi Pyramid Head in it. That's the thing that exists.
He's not wrong. It's real.
That actually exists.
he's actually the antagonist of Chibi Robo Ziplash.
Right. Well, just like Konami is. They do that. They had in Elebits. They had the rabbit with the bloody face that from Silent Hill 3, I think.
A
cameo, prominent cameo, and he's got a bloody face in Elebits as well.
So this was something they used to do a lot. I was surprised to find that this actually had kind of a sequel / port on mobile.
It did.
Quite a few years ago as well. Like I said, it's not the kind of thing they really do much these days outside of Pachinko or whatever. I always like it. Sometimes I wish they would have just done a little bit more with their properties. Like, I think Johnny mentions this in his review, like, the Magma Castle stage, which is Dracula's, is just Bowser's Castle. And it's like, a Castlevania stage could be a lot of things, why did it have to be just a direct copy of a Bowser Castle stage?
Because they had a game they were copying from.
True, but there's some that are more original. You get the baseball diamond one, which is pretty wacky from there, things like that. So it didn't have to be quite as slavish as it is, but they make some little adroit changes that I actually kind of like. Like, for instance, speed power-ups, speed boosts are differentiated from offensive weapons. Offensive weapons you'll see as red bells from Twinbee, and then the speed ups are blue bells, and they're rarer, and usually there's more competition for them when you're trying to find them, and they might enable you to cut a big corner on the track or something. I think that's kind of cool, like reducing the randomness a little bit.
Diddy Kong Racing did the same thing.
With Diddy Kong Racing, you could actually level up your power ups, couldn't you?
If you saved them.
In this, you have a sort of somewhat less direct way of doing the same thing, because there are coins, but they're not for increasing your top speed. You sort of bank them, and then you could go to an item shop and buy an upgrade for an item, which means that you'll be able to use it like a couple of times by just collecting it once, or maybe it goes to three even. I haven't even spent all my coins.
Oh, weird.
Really. But so I guess it's like maybe for people who are struggling a little bit in the Grand Prix, they could do that. So, it makes some cool little changes. And on the whole, I just like seeing all these Konami characters put together in this sort of silly way. Musically, I guess at the time, maybe it didn't seem that great because it was basically doing the GBC chip as the sound processor thing that some Konami GBA games did. But unlike Harmony of Dissonance, which sounded like it just wasn't a good fit, these sound more comfortably sort of 8-bit. And it sounds good. I mean, at this point, all GBA music is retro, so I don't mind it being a little more retro, and it's quite nice. You get Metal Gear Solid, Castlevania, parodies, all this kind of stuff in there. It's fine. I really quite like it. And then, the only other things I've really got to say about it is that they do also have this thing of having these little sort of mission modey type things in between cups to allow you to move up the level. So it'd be like, okay, now you've got to beat a certain time trial thing to improve, or in the very last round to get to S class, you get an amusing one where you have to beat a certain time, but you're going around the track backwards while the other seven racers are coming at it forwards. And if you get hit by any of them, you ain't meeting the time. Basically, so, and the thing is, at first they start off as quite a consistent pack, but they sort of naturally spread out at the end. So you could be like, oh, I think I've avoided all of them for now. It's clear sailing from here. And then the Moai head is really straggling away from the pack and just takes you out on the last cut. No! It's good. You know, it is a good Mario Kart close. Pretty brazen, pretty shameless, but it's a good one. And it harkens back to a very different, I mean, I love Mario Kart 8. I've played an absolute shit ton of it, but this harkens back to a different time where it wasn't about, you know, kind of all power sliding and tons of weapons and craziness and all that. It's kind of, it's still wacky and silly, but it's kind of more of a restrained, brand of it that's a little bit more about racing fundamentals, arguably at times, and skipping corners with the harp. And, I like it, even though obviously I'm not going to get a chance to play a multiplayer.
I have to say, I like Konami Crazy Racers better than Super Circuit.
Yeah, I don't know whether I would have done at the time or not, but in terms of I've got Super Circuit as part of the Ambassador program, and go back to playing that now, and then play this. Obviously, it's not a like-for-like comparison, because one of them I've seen and done before, but I think I did enjoy this more. So, if and when it gets to the States, it could be worth looking at for anybody who's not totally kart raced out.
So, two things before we move on. One, I mean, this is kind of a product of the era. There were a lot of kart racers coming out in the GBA space, but looking at it, this one was really early.
Yeah, that's the thing.
I think it was a launch game in America.
Well, no, it was a little bit later than that, I think, wasn't it? Or I forget, maybe it was
GBA,
like
GBA launched in 2000, so...
No, no, it was 2001, but I mean, I think maybe it was a bit after, like, I think was it, over here, I know, for instance, it was June, 2001, that GBA, came, when I got mine at launch. So I think of course, Konami were in straight away with Circle of the Moon, which was too dark. This is definitely not too dark, although it's kind of all a moot point now. But, I remember a friend of mine actually had this game. And I saw it on their GBA, and I could actually see it. So that's always a plus.
You literally saw it on
their GBA. It was really early. I mean, it beat Nintendo's own Mario Kart to the punch, you know? It probably is a bit more hurried, you know, than it might have been, but it's still pretty damn good. One thing that's cool as well is you unlock characters, some secret characters in weird ways, like you do some crazy jump off a speed boost pad and find just an island in the middle of nowhere that has a diamond on it, and that's how you unlock a character. You get Ibisumaru from Goemon, you got the Vic Viper from Gradius.
Gonna ask you about the Vic Viper. What is it? Is there a plane in a car? Because Vic Viper is the plane, not the pilot.
As far as I could tell, it's just the plane has decided to commit itself to terra firma.
I wanted the plane sitting behind the wheel of a cart. That would have been fantastic. Yeah.
Like trying to fit in, but game. Not really.
Yeah, like, don't look at, hello, fellow racers. I am a racer also.
Just act normal.
Mm-hmm. All right, Greg, I appreciate this report from a dead company.
Mm-hmm.
And this comedy eulogy of kart racing. John.
All right. I'm playing through the backlog still, Nintendo this time. I'm going with Shadow of the Colossus. I actually did bring this up on the show a while back. Who knows how many years it was. But I took out a couple of the bosses, but really didn't get that deep into it. So now I've gone through, I think, 11 bosses. I'm on like the 12th boss.
Oh, yeah, you're super late.
Close to the end.
Yep. And so I have a really good idea. And, you know, it's funny, if I probably would have jumped on this game a lot earlier, like when it came out, if somebody would have described it to me as Zelda and Monster Hunter kind of mashed up. Because I kind of knew, yeah, you know, whatever, you take out these big bosses, but I didn't realize later on you get into a lot of, a lot more complex sort of like baiting of these monsters that you're trying to take down. It's never really very hard to kill them, because typically once you figure out the mechanic, like that's it. Right?
Yeah.
You have to do this one thing and you do it and it's done. Which is what I like about it, because it's really stripped down. You know, there's no, they don't try to like wrap some, you know, crazy story around it. You know, there's no.
It's there's monster. Oh, you killed monster. Here's next monster. Go and get.
Yep. So it's really good. So, I mean, I'm enjoying it and, it's a quick playthrough. So, but, yeah, I mean, really it's really, really unique. I really like the atmosphere. You know, it still looks great after all these years. I'm playing the HD one, that was, ported by Bluepoint.
Yeah. So John, I played this game in the winter. I actually marathoned it and Eco in like a 3-day window.
Yep.
I remember walking away from this game. Well, first of all, did you play Eco at any point?
I have not played Eco, no.
Okay. I'll be curious if you go back and play that, what your thoughts on it. I thought Shadow of the Colossus kind of succeeds, and maybe you can, you know, give me your take on it, because it really tries to do a thing. And anytime it does anything that's not the A thing, which is deal with these bosses, it feels jank.
It's, yeah, I mean, I would criticize it for, it has pretty clunky controls.
Yeah.
But
that one thing it does.
Yes.
It's like super good at it.
Yeah. It's, oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, like the actual, the process of finding a boss, seeing the boss, figuring out what the mechanic is, it's amazing. You know,
well, and there's that oh shit moment with some of the bosses.
Oh,
where
yeah.
You wander in, you go, oh, there's nothing here, and oh no.
Yeah, they do a really good job with the sense of scale with these mm-hmm. creatures.
So, have you done the one that's on the bridge yet? It is a ravine, and there's two bridges, and you have to run back and forth between them because it's essentially, well, okay.
Nope. That's probably.
That one is gigantic.
Yeah.
And it's hauntingly big.
Yeah, probably the best one that I've done so far. The one that I'm at is the one in the lake where you have to you have to like hop up on top of one of the little kind of temples in the lake, and then you have to hop back onto him.
Oh,
and then
yeah.
You have to like go under him, like underwater, and
bait him over there to you too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I've done the one, the flying one was really, really cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It is.
But I mean, like, yeah. I mean, there's some serious time. Yeah, I mean, you're definitely right. There's holy shit a lot in this game where you're like, okay, cool. The boss sitting there, you're just like, whoa, what the hell? Like, you know, like with the flying boss where it dives right at you, and you're like, what the hell do I do? I guess I jump up, and all of a sudden you're on the back of it. But then even from there, you're like flying around, and there's like a real sense of speed, and you know, you're fighting against the wind. So well done.
There's a really tiny one, kind of in the middle of the game.
Mm-hmm.
This is like if you were to compare the Wanderer to a human, it'd be like the size of a rhinoceros, so tiny, relatively speaking.
Yeah.
And you walk in there, you're thinking, oh, this guy's going to get jacked up real fast.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's just blazingly fast, and there's just the holy shit translates from normally when you see them to, oh, God, oh, God, oh, God, oh, God, oh, God, oh, God, I need to get, oh, God, oh, God, what's happening right now?
Well, I mean,
just
the
constant
one,
running.
Yeah, I mean, the one boss that I just beat that I really had a hell of a time with, because usually these bosses are actually, you know, like once you figure things out, you can take them out relatively quickly. I mean, I'm probably averaging, I think each boss I beat, I probably spent about 30 minutes on it.
That's about right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the one boss I had a hell of a time with was the one where you have to, it's like a panther kind of thing. And it, mm-hmm. it's scared of fire. You have to get the torch. That one was horrible because with that one, if you do the mechanic right, you can beat it no time flat, which is what I did when I finally figured it out and came back. But I pretty much rage quit it the first time because what would happen?
His mechanic is crazy.
His mechanic is crazy. And the thing is, if you miss it and screw it up, he can sit there and knock you over. And then you try to get up and he just sits there and knocks you over again.
Yeah.
It's so brutal. So what he did is, you know, you have to knock him off the platform and then hop down onto him and kill him. But what I did this first time was after figuring that out, which took me a while, after I figured that out, I jumped off the platform. You're supposed to jump off the platform and jump onto his back. Well, I missed him and he got up and then he just beat my ass. And then, of course, you have to climb all the way. You have to go back up the hill to get back to the platform. And he just beat my ass all the way up. So I would get up. He would knock me over. I'd get up. He would knock me over. Seriously, this happened probably about 15 times all the way up the hill. Because I could not get away from him, and there's nothing in the game to let you avoid him.
And see, that's the thing where I'd say, like, there's parts of the game that are just janky. Like, they didn't give you a mechanism to stay away from him.
Yeah. Yep. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's a cool game, and I'm glad you're actually getting into it. I kind of, you're right, it is Zelda mixed with Monster Hunter. So I'm going to recommend a game to you that when you've got some time,
mm-hmm.
when you've got, like, real, like, nothing in the backlog – Mm-hmm. Maybe give it a go.
So never.
It's 2055.
All right. I understand what I just said. Lay off. And I talked about this a little bit. And it was not Portable Ops, Metal Gear Solid. I'm blanking on what the name
is now.
Peace Walker. Yeah, because there is the boss fights in that are very much set up like Monster Hunter boss fights, to the point that they signed a deal with Capcom to feature Monster Hunter in the game.
So there's a
mission where if you walk backwards from the start of the mission, you meet your a Palico who takes you to Monster Hunter Island.
What?
And then you fight Monster Hunter monsters.
Yeah, Solid Snake?
As Solid Snake, yes. But cool, I'm really glad you're getting in there, because I really enjoyed that game, and you're right. It does kind of strike multiple notes that should make it a good game for you to enjoy as well.
Yeah, and so. I play through it, and I'm like, man, they really need to release a sequel to this for PS4. Just keep it
the
same.
The Last Guardian, bro.
Last Guardian, but that's
Eco. That's really more Eco.
Yeah, that's not Shadow of the Colossus.
I don't think we completely know that for sure yet.
Well, I mean, we know it's not Shadow of the Colossus, because Shadow of the Colossus is such a singularly focused thing.
Mm. Yeah.
I would say, you know, the guy who is behind all those games, I think, is Fumito Ueda.
Yes.
He split with Sony a couple years ago, so he's been on The Last Guardian the last couple years just as a contractor or some kind of consultant, I think. So I'm guessing once The Last Guardian's out, he's probably not going to be working with Sony anymore. And I'm just saying, Nintendo, this guy might have something you want.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
With a little guidance, you know, working under Onuma, Miyamoto, etc.
Yeah, maybe get some pretty cool controls ideas. A bit tighter.
Yeah.
Nintendo really needs help not putting out games. That's true.
I'm pretty bitter because
The Last Guardian was supposed to come out for PlayStation 3, all right? Yeah. That didn't happen.
No, it did not. Well, I mean, you say that, but we'll see if it comes out for PlayStation 4.
Yeah, I'm not sure yet.
It will.
So I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up with an update. Just a real quick update on Legend of Legacy. The Legend of Legacy, as John and I found out when we were doing Now Playing This.
Yes.
The Legend of the Legacy.
Yeah, because we couldn't find it in the list of game titles, and then we realized it starts with T. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't, because that's how alphabetizing works, but whatever. So I was about 2 or 3 hours in last week, and I'm about 17 in now. Now, that's 17 of what the game regards my time played. I does not count all the many hours I have lost because the game just sucker punched me and I went down. So I wanted to give a couple pointers to avoid the frustration I've had playing The Legend of Legacy. One, if you have a tank character, use the shield all the time. Why? Because the shield, so here's how it works. When you level up skills is based on dice rolls, but it's weighted dice rolls apparently. I haven't been able to confirm that. This game's going to have a great game facts in about a year when somebody figures out how all these freaking systems work. But right now, you're on your own. Figure it out. That as per usage, randomly you get the chance of getting the next skill up. And then randomly you have a chance of that skill leveling up with each usage. So as your skills level up, they become more effective and you potentially get access to newer, better skills. It may cost more energy, but they're usually worth it. Once I had a dedicated tank in a defensive stance learning like the shield moves, he now almost always returns or blocks every single physical attack directed at my party and returns it for 300 plus damage. That is a game changer in terms of making this game playable. Because before, it just felt like I was always on the verge of getting killed by even the weakest enemies. So that allowed me to gain experience for the other characters in their various stats. The second step is find a role. Beyond just that guy, you know, my elementalist mirrors is now just rocking in terms of his magical capabilities. Now, I ground him really hard as a dagger user, so he's still got that, but really he's now full-time elementalist, and it's worked out really well. And the last one, and the most, two more. Number three, use the ship. When you go buy, so in town there's a port, and you can give them money to have a ship go out and get you stuff. It just comes back with some random items. You would think it's about Street Pass, because he asked you, do you want to turn on Street Pass? If you don't have Street Pass on or don't want to assign it, you could still say no, and the ship will still go out. Don't bother with the two cheaper ships. Buy the 5,000 gold one, because I got like game end level gear in the second dungeon from that thing. And pretty much every time I send the boat out, I get something worse than that, but still way better than I can buy in the shops when I'm now in like end game territory. Hmm. And since drops of items are so infrequent in this game, just do that. It's it is an instant like 10 level boost, even though the game doesn't really have levels. And lastly, and most importantly, quick save, despite reading like it is a save and jump back to the menu so you can continue from where you left off, is not that.
The game actually tells you it will jump back to the menu, and then it doesn't.
Yes, yes. Save is actually a second save slot that you can use anywhere in the world.
Yep.
So as opposed to having to leave the whole map and save and then get back to where you were, because remember, when you run from battle, you go back to the very first screen of this map that you're on. That could be 20 minutes the other direction. This save lets you save and reload right back where you were even when you die, meaning all the risk is gone. So this game that had an unbearable amount of punishing risk. If you run from a battle, you're sent back 20 plus minutes. If you die, you're done and you lose all your progress because the only save point's back in town. All of that risk was gone, and suddenly I was able to make progress, and I didn't have to run away from battles out of fear I was going to just lose everything and then have to start the whole dungeon over again. It lost the stuff that was making me feel almost like this was an Etrian game and all the bad ways that means. And
there's no bad ways.
There are bad ways.
No.
And I was able to get back into just the groove of moving through dungeons, and I was able to start clearing dungeons at a not completely illogical and grinding clip. And also because I was willing to stay in fights longer, my characters got better. So I'm now better suited for combat, and I'm better prepared for the possibility of losing it, so I'm willing to play it with a little bit more risk. It's made the game infinitely
and,
more
approachable. There's even a shortcut for the quick save. Like, you hold down the R button and you press X.
Oh my god.
Yep.
Guillaume just made this even easier for me. So, like, yeah, this is like that quick save, even though it totally lies about what it's doing, is like the most vital thing in the game to know about. It's unbelievably how much it changed my experience of that game. I was on the verge of quitting it. And then I got this, I'm like, oh, never mind. I'm better now.
I played the demo of Legend of Legacy a couple weeks ago, and I really liked the demo because it saved me $50.
Boo. There you go.
I've played a little bit with the elemental magic stuff, but I don't understand it. Like, you've got an elementalist. Wait. Can you call more than just the one? Like, it seems like your magic is tied to these stones, but... Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, all right, so let me give an explanation here, because again, there's no game facts written for this thing yet. So
sounds like you should be the one, James.
I don't have that kind of time. And I'm still figuring this game out, too. So magic is tied to stones. You get these stones from out the game world, and they tell you kind of backstory about this war between a king and a queen on this continent that sunk beneath the ocean. So before you can use any magic of that type, generally speaking, you have to get the...
Singing Stone.
The Singing Stone. There's three of those in the game. One for each of the game's three elements. Why the game only has three elements? Wind, water, and fire? I don't know. But it does. There's a fourth one, but you don't get a Singing Stone for it. At least not that I've seen. That's Darkness, which is what the enemies all use. So, the Singing Stone lets you essentially forge a contract with these elements. And you have to have a contract forged to use magic. And the contracts go away after the battle ends. Sometimes you'll be in a zone where you've, like an area of the map where you've interacted with something in the map and set up the influence there, and you'll start with that contract in place. But then you get these stone shards, which you get from rocks throughout the game world, that let you use magic spells in specific. Now, you have to set up the contract, and then you can use the spells.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has two accessory slots, and the singing stones and shards take up those accessories, but other things also take up accessories, like my tank is using a mid-level healing item as opposed to using a singing stone. So as you use these stone shard skills, randomly, you may learn them. An elementalist is more likely to learn them than, say, a natural tank. But they can all learn them with usage. So I spent a lot of time just grinding mirrors, and just once I had the shield block up, so it was basically 100% of the time, just standing there and having mirrors use a skill over and over again, because I forged a contract with wind, which allows your SP to regenerate faster every turn. So he could just use it infinitely, and he just kept using this skill until he'd wiped out all the enemies, or until he had learned it, and then wipe out all the enemies. So your spells level up, and in fact, if you learn a spell and then you level it up, you may actually learn the next spell without using the stone shard.
So it's like the weapons.
Right. So he has that magic. But That magic of that type is only available to him is if he is holding a singing stone or stone shard of that element,
okay,
like the weapons. So any one character can only be using two colors of magic at one time.
Hmm.
So Mears right now is almost entirely focused on green, although he has some blue skills. If I want him to learn a new green spell or a new blue spell, I have to take off the stone that's giving him access to the other color so he can get that stone. Or I just need to grind the ones he has in the hopes that he naturally learns a new spell. It's not complicated. It's just not explained. It's not explained in the guide. Right. It's not explained in the game. I will say, have a tank. Having a tank has made all the difference in the world. It's really opened up what I can do with the other two characters because we're not constantly just trying to stay alive. Now it's a matter of I've shifted from trying to stay alive to trying to keep my magic up while just hammering them with skills and developing these characters. And that has made all the difference. Well, that and quick saving has made all the difference.
Nice.
Cool. So that's going to do it for new business. That's a lot of new business. After this, we're going to come back from a mournful break with discussion about some topics, including Nintendo NX and maybe a little bit about what episode 450 means to me. Congrats to these guys. Stay tuned. Now playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have a review of Fatal Frame, Maiden of the Black Water on Wii U by Andrew Brown. Carrying a camera around and taking creepy pictures isn't just something that John does for fun anymore. It's now a video game. In fact, it's a long-running series that's been reviewed on the Wii U, and word is that it's pretty good. See what Andrew has to say about the lack of bikini outfits in his review.
Pretty creepy.
It's pretty creepy.
I'm an expert.
Yeah, we've really asked you to stop taking that camera into the restrooms.
It's just for archival photos.
It's art. You don't understand. We also have a preview. Final Fantasy Explorers on 3DS by Josh Max. Josh gets a chance to play this upcoming dungeon crawler and also managed to throw some sideways shade at Final Fantasy VII in the process. Not bad, Josh. You have promise. We'll be keeping an eye on you.
Pretty creepy again.
Pretty creepy.
Yeah.
We'll be keeping the camera lens on you.
Alright, we got a preview. Yo-Kai Watch. Everybody wants to know about Yo-Kai Watch, right? By Josh Max. Curious, bud, what has Japan all in a tizzy?
No, I bought that already.
Josh.
Oh, you mean Yo-Kai Watch. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Josh goes to New York Comic Con and gives us a quick look. Tastes like Pokemon.
That's not what it tastes like. Oh, wait. Yo-Kai Watch. Sorry.
Yeah.
Mistake.
Mm. Okay, and we have a review of The Legend of Zelda Triforce Heroes for 3DS by Neil Ronahan. Just a single-player version, though, James.
Just a single-player.
Yeah. Neil takes a look at the single-player portion of this new Zelda title, holding off on reviewing the multiplayer modes, local and online, until later on. There's no final score here, but there is a final verdict as to whether or not you should buy the game for the single player. Look for a final score next week. Yeah. So about that online multiplayer. Yeah.
So the problem right now is I'm trying to tell you how I feel about this game. There's a voice chat in the Skype call.
Yeah.
So I'm just waving pom-poms around.
Yeah, fortunately there's no lag here, though. No lag on this call. So, unlike
find this
Triforce Heroes.
Oh. Cast a sideways shade. You can find this and more pom-poms available to you right... Actually, no, you can't, because we don't actually have the review of Mario Tennis Towers we're going up this week. You can find this and more emoticons available to you right now. Right now. Under the glaring lens of ghosts and Japanese people in a tizzy. But no bikinis.
I also believe the term is actually emojis. No,
emojis? Is it emoji? Did we change it?
Yeah. It's what the kids are saying. I don't make it up.
You can find this in more kids on NintendoWorldReport.com. And we're back. We're going to be talking about NX this week because we wanted to kind of have something to talk about that's a little bit different given, you know, the vast array of knowledge we've assembled. We're going to talk a little bit about some news that broke. I guess it broke while we were recording last week, actually.
Everything happens while we're recording.
It does.
And then everybody asks why we didn't talk about it.
Or into the immediate aftermath. Like within 10 minutes of us stopping recording, news will break in.
We're going to be the last people to know about the zombie apocalypse.
That's right. Nintendo will do their next Nintendo Direct while we are recording, and we will not have known it was going to happen. And we'll go to bed, and then we'll get up Monday morning, and they'll be, or Friday morning, and they'll all be mobile games only, and we'll just be sitting there staring into the abyss wondering what happened. But Wall Street Journal had a report last week that Nintendo has started to send out development kits for their new NX system. This is, of course, not the first we've heard about NX. We heard about NX earlier in the year when Nintendo announced their plans for their mobile partnership with DNA as sort of their, no, we're not going mobile. We are adding that as a new facet of our corporate footprint. So we haven't heard much about what NX is. We've had the long history of comments that Mr. Iwata made prior to his passing about where he wants the company to get. We've seen the company restructuring that's been going on for the last year or so. That's clearly moving them in a certain direction. But this is the first concrete report we've had about tangible NX-related things getting into the wild. Short of Square Enix committing to every game ever made will be released on NX. So what we announced before we get into the conversation, I'll just run through and announce. What was reported was that the development kits that have gone out essentially indicate that there will be at least two form factors for this for the NX. I don't want to say system if there's different factors to it, but there will be two form factors of the NX, a mobile and a console version. And that it, quote, has industry-leading chips, which I'll let John explain when we discuss this on Sunday what that means.
Not ready
I can't
for
remember
that?
What...
Industry-leading. Note, it doesn't say what industry.
Yeah, it's true.
And that was a throwback for me. I felt like I was reading the old British gaming magazines who used to talk about what chips things had in them and all that.
Yeah.
Like, next-gen chips, guys. Next-gen.
Yeah, these are named Panda.
I mean, that's it. That's the whole story, that they've sent out preliminary development kits.
And it was attributed to a source familiar with the development. I think it was as vague as that.
Sure.
Yes.
It's a now, game this, developer. Look.
It's
significant in that, you know, the fact that they're sending out development kits, although usually they do this in phases, so like certain premier developers or premier publishers will get them first.
The ones they get are usually fairly primitive in the first shot.
Yeah, and also I think they're seen as being the companies that are best positioned to provide feedback on, you know, hey, can you fatten up this particular pipe, you know, in the data stream or whatever in order to help us do this quickly, you know, more quickly, et cetera. And I think they probably get a few pointers on, you know, certain things about the interface of the development kit itself, you know, so how the tools are organized. You know, are they compatible? Are they crashing a lot on certain systems? Blah, blah, blah. But the fact that Nintendo is sending that stuff out now and even could have been doing it, you know, sometime in the past, and maybe we're only now finding out about it, but at least we could say as of today, development kits are going out. It tells you something about how far away this system is, i.e. not that far.
Right. But it's also not super imperatively close either.
I'm sure not. I mean, it's not coming out this holiday season.
Because these are still at least seemingly preliminary dev kits. These aren't dev kits for the final hardware. At least based on what we're seeing.
To me, it keeps hope alive. If this is something you would hope for, but it keeps alive the possibility that NX could actually come out in the year 2016 and not just be talked about for the first time by Nintendo. And you know, and certainly there's still a possibility of 2017. And at this point, Nintendo even themselves may not know for sure. Maybe they're kind of fielding it. Maybe that's part of the feedback cycle with these companies that they're giving out kits to. But if they're just now giving out third party kits, that means they've had internal development going on for longer than that. And they've known about what the system is and about what kinds of games they're making for it for longer than that. And I think 2016 is a distinct possibility now, whereas a couple of weeks ago, a lot of people might have told you, not likely. And I think now I don't know if I want to say likely, but I think it is definitely impossible. And it, you know, that's significant if you look at the amount of money that Nintendo is not making on the Wii U and the 3DS sales are slowing down a lot. It's important to them to get out this new hardware as soon as they can do so viably. And I think 2016, if they can do it, they will.
So I will say that this isn't the first time we've heard stuff, but – This is the first time that it corresponds cleanly with other things, like Nintendo restructuring their entire development communities, their third-party development utility communities, like on the same day, which is kind of a, okay, so something really did happen. They probably set up a new community for these developers for NX that are, they've segregated out from everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
It's the end of the Wario World community, which was not a well-kept secret. But remember, this is also how we originally heard about the Wii U, was they set up these dev communities for the Project Cafe stuff.
Yeah.
And that stuff started to leak out, and then we were able to kind of, stuff kind of came through that way. So, unlike the rumors we had heard previously out of Japan, i.e. that this is a device running some kind of Android, this one actually sounds credible. And also, it's not from Nikkei, who will run literally any rumor from any source and treat it like fact. The Wall Street Journal reporting this is a different breed. It's a much bigger. They did not run this with one source. Let's put it that way.
Oh no.
They had at least 2 to 3 completely independent sources verify what they heard, which means also there are 2 to 3 independent sources who could verify this that they could find. So it's not like they sent one of these to Capcom and said, "All right, Capcom gets one and Ubisoft gets one, and that's it." Like there's a decent number of these things out in the wild. So.
Yeah, I don't know if or to what extent this will translate to third-party support for the NX. I don't think we know enough about the system to have a feel for what that could be. But I will say that I got the sense that Nintendo was talking to third parties this year at E3 to a level that they have not for a long time.
I mean, they almost had to, because there basically was no existing communication otherwise, because they weren't making games for Nintendo systems, so it was not like they had regular meetings going on.
Yeah. Well, there were regular meetings at E3 this year. I saw it with my own eyes.
Yeah. And that's ultimately, when we talk about E3, it's not just for the media. Like it is it is an industry event, and that is businessmen doing business, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I do, you know, before we, you know, keep pontificating on what a dev kit means to me, it is.
What does it really mean to you personally, James?
Yeah, I mean, you know,
to me, it's the moon shining over a lake on a cold September night.
Thank you. So it's like,
it's the smell of pumpkin spice in the morning.
I just don't want us to get too caught up in discussing like what a dev kit's, what the first wave of dev kits hitting third parties means. I mean, it means that people can start doing proof of concepts on games. Like that's what it means. And beyond that, that's really it.
Well, yeah, I mean, but I think that whoever they would have sent it out to is probably doing it on already. They have PCs that approximate the specs anyways. I mean, this would probably just be the start of official development and not hacking around.
Well, I mean, that may be what they sent them to, though. They may have sent them.
True.
These may not be development NX devices. These may just be PCs that can approximate the specs.
Yeah, they may be tuned to what you should expect as a target. And also, it probably includes some tools to compile to the format so that you can start making sure that the thing, you know, the ideas that you have will be compatible with the code base, with the tools that, you know, with the interfaces and things like that. And by the way, when Nintendo does this, I think it, again, the information that they provide that's very specific to what the platform is probably a little bit different for every company, because they trust different companies different amounts with the kinds of information they give out. But the companies that are now working on NX not only know how powerful the system will probably be based on the dev kits that they have and the software tools that Nintendo is providing, but Nintendo to some extent is going to have to explain to them what the concept is. And that may have actually happened before these dev kits started going out.
Yeah. And kind of what the form factor is going to be.
Yeah. Like what is the NX in a kind of a broad sense? Like what should you be thinking about? What kinds of game ideas might you want to be sort of, you know, what games are you already sort of in the pre-production phases of that you might want to bring to NX, or what kinds of things might you want to start to assemble into like early game ideas that would be appropriate for the NX? And that's happening. Now, it may be a while before we hear about that, because that is the most secret part of all this. And that's the part that, you know, the kinds of developer sources that would talk to a newspaper are going to be the most anxious about revealing, because when they reveal it, they might also reveal themselves. Because Nintendo is smart enough to give slightly different versions or different subsets of information to different people. And that way, when something does leak out, they know who did it, or at least that's the threat, right? Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. So, you don't know if they gave you the same. I mean, you could compare notes with somebody else, but that's really the best you can do. So, the other thing that's gone part and parcel with this, with their new development portal that they rolled out, which obviously is for the lead up to this, you know, their descriptions on the new dev portal talk about how their goal is to quote, make your lives easier, letting you self-publish, digitally publish, and publish at retail. And they have this thing called the Nintendo Development Interface, which is a client tool for SDK development that allows easy use of the relevant guidelines and documentation that you'll need for your work. So essentially, they've got a new dev environment for making games, which now is also corresponding with new dev kits, which presumably that means they're trying to make this the least painful process possible, which is something they always say they're trying to do. Then they talked about in the GameCube, like, you can do these effects so easily, but it's a question now of, like, do they understand what makes making a game easy? Like, what they can do to make this process as much of what the opposite of not painful is. Not painful. But it does seem like all of these things are happening at roughly the same time. So, you know, maybe this is a make good. Maybe this is like a we get it thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what third parties would want to see. The major third parties, if the NX sells units, which is, of course, its own question, if they can put their games on the system, it's relatively easy to do so, then, yeah, they probably will put at least some of them on there. It's a question of, you know, is it easy to do? And hopefully that's what Nintendo is trying to do, because by the time this thing gets to market, they will have been making games for these current platforms for multiple years, and in theory will be developed enough or experienced enough that this isn't a challenge for them anymore. So they're already behind the eight ball a little bit. The people are going to have to learn this new hardware. So hopefully they've, you know, in their conversations with developers, that's come up, and they are doing as best they can to make sure that's not an issue. But we'll see, I suppose. The other thing that I wanted to touch on briefly with the very little information that we have right now, very, very, I mean, just a tiny piece of information that came out of that Wall Street Journal article, because there's not a lot to it, really. It is what appears to be the confirmation of what we had kind of pontificated about, the multiple form factor of what NX is. Now, what they don't say in the article, not explicitly at least, is that this is the same system in different shapes. They say that the exact shape of the NX hardware isn't yet clear. People familiar with the development plan said Nintendo would likely include both a console and at least one mobile unit that could be either used in conjunction with the console or taken on the road for separate use. Mm-hmm. So there's two things there. So people familiar with development plans said they would likely include both a console and at least one mobile unit. Does that mean it is the same thing? Is the same package?
Doesn't sound like it.
I think it's going to be more like, you know, iPod, iPad, iPad Pro, etc. They run a lot of the same software,
right?
But it's like modularized, so it runs a little bit differently on each one to, you know, fit the screen and fit the power level that's available. But you could buy it once and play it on all three. If you look at, there was the rumor, and I don't know how much truth there is to this rumor, but it was fairly recent that, or it wasn't a rumor, it was a patent that we found that we think is related to the NX that described a home console that had no disk drive, but instead had a physical memory card reader that games would be loaded on. That makes a lot of sense if you think that a handheld device that would run the same software probably would not have a disk drive. And therefore, it wouldn't make sense to sell the games on disks if the goal was to make them compatible with both a home unit and a mobile unit.
Right.
Like, so you could just have an SD card.
Or it might be more like a 3DS game card. But regardless, if you want to buy it physically, you buy it on that, and then you can plug that into both the home system and the mobile, and you only have to buy it once. Or you could download it and presumably, you know, download it to both systems and play it interchangeably that way too.
Right. So if that is the way that the wind is blowing here, do we think there would be exclusive software for one format or the other? My personal guess is yes.
I would think so, because I don't know how you could get around, if the mobile unit and the console were very similar power-wise, I think you would kind of run into sort of the, you know, you would just run into issues like you're playing Crossy Road. It's like Apple TV at that point, you know,
yeah.
Where it's more, the specs are low, so it's not really a console experience. It's more of a...
Right, because you wouldn't want to jam power into a handheld device because you're going to nuke your battery.
Exactly. Mm. So, I mean, what I think it's going to be is it's going to be like console games, but then kind of robust mobile games that complement the console experience, but are almost not just spin-off games, but rather, you know, an integral part. You know, if I look at what they're doing with Pokemon Go as any kind of indicator, they're kind of into that sort of location-based gaming and stuff like that.
The games they make on 3DS, some of them are equivalent to consoleized games, but a lot of them are kind of a different format. You know, they're built differently.
Yeah.
I would presume they would continue to build both of those types of experiences.
But you would be able to choose. So, for instance, a game that might seem better suited to handheld, but let's say you don't like playing on handhelds for whatever reason. Like you know, I always drive myself, so I never get to play. I play my 3DS at home almost exclusively.
Yeah.
And so for me, when I feel like it, I could, or if I just don't even want to buy the handheld system at all, I can still play all the handheld games on my home console. I just plug them in, you know, and they scale up. Maybe they don't look as nice as the games that are specifically made for the home console, but they work just fine. They're all compatible with the same controller. It's not a big deal. And of course, if you're just downloading all this stuff, then it's all the same, right? Like it doesn't really matter what system it was intended for. If you're just downloading it, but in the case of physical stuff, it's like, you know, you could, I don't know. To me, this seems like a fairly elegant thing, because if you think about it, like for third parties, it's a way to tell them, you know, if you think about all the games that are being made now as download only titles and as Steam games and things like that, if there's a way to release those on Nintendo systems where you could play them either as a handheld or on the TV, and you don't have to make two different versions. It's like the dev kit basically does the scaling for you because they run on a common code base. And so you can just tweak a few things and make it look good on both systems, but essentially make the game once and then just sort of do a very simple porting process to make it compatible with both. And you can release the game once, and this is a great solution for third parties, because they want to know, hey, are there going to be enough people owning the system that could potentially buy my game? If not, then I'm not going to make it for your system, right? But what this means is they can make it once and sell it to potentially two different markets of Nintendo people.
Well, and it also solves, to a certain extent, the Japan problem.
Yeah,
exactly. I think that's the biggest thing, is just that you have this situation I've talked about before. They have this situation where, you know, obviously personal preference comes into it a lot, but how it breaks down across, you know, Japan and the West, that people, you know, entire genres are sort of viewed differently to me, as how, you know, people might prefer to play them. So, you know, sometimes you might think, well, you make a game ideally for the 3DS, for the Japanese market, but maybe that, even though the 3DS still has a bigger install base in America too, is it just the kind of game that people are willing to play on portables in the States? You know, and this eradicates that whole kind of barrier, and hopefully would be one less reason for people, for third parties to hesitate to bring something.
So we talk about all the examples we've had of cross. I don't want to use the word crossplay, 'cause something else uses that term, but all the examples we've talked about are portable up. Do we think that there would be console exclusive ones that are just trying to sap that thing's power to its maximum and just wouldn't work on a lower power handheld?
Yeah, I think there would be, but I think Nintendo would at least provide the option. I don't think game makers would have to do this. I think they could choose, but I think at least for Nintendo's first party games, they would probably, for games like, let's say, Xenoblade Chronicles X, you know, this game that like seems to like really maximize the potential of the Wii U. It really pushes the hardware. It looks incredible. You can't really imagine them doing a handheld version of that for a long time to come. But maybe Nintendo, when they make a game like that that's really big and high production and is really only suited to the home console, they include an app or some aspect of the experience that you can take with you on the home. So even if you buy the game physically, you have it on a piece of plastic that you plug into your system when you're playing it at home, but then you go on vacation and you want to bring some piece of it with you, you can just unplug that thing, put it in your handheld system and take it with you, and you can get some piece of it. Now, obviously, for a lot of third parties, that's not super appealing because it means they have to develop additional stuff, right?
Right.
And they're not necessarily selling an extra copy of it for the handheld because, it, you know, you would be using the same copy of the game. But I think it would be a way for some developers to kind of differentiate the Nintendo version if they want to, or they could take, for instance, you know, a lot of console games now have a mobile app or a mobile game that sort of accompanies them that's essentially free to play, right? It could make money off microtransactions or something like that, and it's just sort of branded. Well, maybe that is the handheld version. And it doesn't necessarily cost them a lot of money to put it on that system. And they know they're not going to make a lot of money selling it, and they're not trying to sell it. It's included as sort of an extra that you get when you buy the console version. But it may be an avenue for them to make additional money through some kind of microtransactions on the handheld version. So that may be a way to get, you know, especially a lot of these Western developers, although some Japanese as well, to try to make something to support on that handheld version, even if the primary game that they're doing is really a console experience.
Right, because you would go ahead.
You could use it for like Street Pass type stuff couldn't you? You know, I mean,
that's true.
But for, you know, games that you primarily play at home, but you know, this is where the importance of the integrated unified account comes in that we've been promised that, you know,
we're supposed to get this year, right?
Yeah, you know, with all the maintenance that's going on right now, we've just had one round, we've got another round coming up round about the time this show's going up. You know, there's a lot of we keep hearing about the first mobile game from the DNA partnership being unveiled soon. And, you know, it feels like this is just about to start, you know, being unveiled in some fashion that might give us more clues as to where all this stuff is pointing. But definitely if you've got a unified account there, so at least, you know, the mobile aspect of it knows what games you've been playing on the other device and all that, then you could at least have, you know, some sort of rudimentary kind of Street Pass type functionality where it shares data with other people that played the games and that kind of, but it could be, you know, kind of have that kind of viral component, to kind of people wanting to kind of broadcast the fact they're playing certain games, could take it to another level beyond what Street Pass does, which of course outside of Japan is not especially fruitful, I imagine.
Right. And you know, there's another way that they could kind of approach this, and John, I think you would have the most experience with this of us here, but you know, Sony for years has been doing this remote play thing with PSP and now Vita. And it's not a matter of like streaming over Gaikai servers or something like that. It's you set up a dedicated Wi-Fi connection to your home console between that and your handheld. And as if you have a Wi-Fi hotspot with fast enough data rate, you can turn on your system at home, play any game on it, and it just streams to your handheld, and it's like you're playing the console. And for some games or for some people and for some situations, apparently it works really well. And I think that technology is not new. And it could be that maybe Nintendo has learned enough about wireless game streaming through their work on the Wii U that maybe now they think they can take a version of that over the internet and maybe do that in a way that they would be acceptable at least for certain games.
Yeah, I mean, entirely possible. I mean, definitely on Vita. I haven't done it too much. I don't really need to, but I've heard of people playing very, very advanced games on that.
Oh, well, like across the world. You like the game is running on their system at home on another continent, and they're playing it on their Vita. And for some people, it seems to work extremely well. Mm-hmm. And you know, if the handheld has equivalent controls to the home console controller, or even if the handheld is the home console controller potentially, then you could see that working really well as long as the latency is addressed. And again, that's something where Nintendo has spent a lot of time and money developing technology to reduce wireless latency. So, And it, that gives them a kind of a bridge from the gamepad functionality that people like so much, because obviously if you could do that remotely, then you could certainly do that within your home, right? And so you still get all the benefits of the gamepad, but now you're not as tethered to only be able to use it inside your own home. You can still take it with you and do something similar even when you're far away.
Yeah, I mean, don't forget too that DNA, they have this streaming tech that they unveiled, the Mirative stuff, I think it's called. Yeah, it's mobile streaming.
How are they using it?
This is from August. DNA, which made headlines earlier this year when it struck a partnership with Nintendo Company to develop its video games for smartphones, will enter an increasingly competitive market where live streaming apps like Meerkat and Twitter's recently acquired Periscope vie for users. But unlike streaming apps released so far, which are basically specialized in live streaming video or mobile games, Mirative streams anything happening on the user's screen without the need to log in with other services or devices, or register with other services or devices, rather.
I was about to correct you because we're reading the same article now.
Yep.
This is competitive reading on RFN. This is why you had 450 episodes of us reading to you at the same time.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, very, very curious.
This is like Twitch for mobile devices, essentially.
Not really. Actually, I mean, really, it reminds me, like, on PC, it reminds me more of, like, something like VNC, if anybody's ever used that. That's real computer nerd stuff. But yeah. It streams whatever's happening on your screen. So it's not streaming the game to something. It's just whatever's happening on your device.
Well, yeah. So I'm looking at the screenshot they provide, and it's somebody playing a DNA game while the obviously cropped picture of someone from iStock Photo is looking down, presumably at a device with the text telling them, "You're too good, lol."
Lol. But
so this may be something that not every game can support, depending on, you know, depending on input lag requirements and things like that. But again, you know, there's a lot of ways that Nintendo can sort of communicate to the user, you know, what features are supported for any particular game.
Nintendo is also the 10% owner of DNA.
Mm-hmm.
It's worth pointing out. Mm-hmm. So, but Nintendo also hasn't done streaming before, whereas the other two systems have it built in to some extent.
Well, they
do.
Again, they do a version of it with the Wii U. It's very different. The way that it's done is different, but the user experience is very similar. So again, I think the theme with NX, and this is speculation on my part, but I think everything is kind of pointing in this direction and sort of converging on this. I think the theme will be sort of universality. It's you buy the game and you can play it wherever. You can play it at home. You can play it on your mobile device. You only have to buy one copy of it. And not every single game will be able to support that, but a lot of them will. And for developers, it's universal because you make the game once and it works on both systems. And we've doubled the install base because some people don't want a home console. Some people don't want a handheld. But you can appeal to both of them at the same time, and you only have to make the game once.
No, and of course they can do what they've done with their portables in the past and keep releasing iterations, revisions. Sometimes they might have a little bit of extra processing power under the hood or whatever, right, like a DSi.
Special editions.
So then you're going to sell the real Nintendo enthusiasts a lot more than just two devices. It's one platform, multiple devices that could expand over time and presubably sort of evolve a bit more organically than these discrete platform jumps that we've had every 5 years.
Especially the handheld units are much easier to iterate. So it's easy to imagine you have the NX Pocket that's the small version that's super portable, and you can have the NX Pro, which is bigger and heavier, but maybe has longer battery life or something like that. You know, there's a lot of ways that they could take that, and it's worked really well for a lot of other companies that they're essentially now competing with already.
So I guess for me, the trick is how do you maintain the hardware sales of both devices? Because that is the key element to Nintendo's money-making plan is the sale of devices.
Well, I mean, if one of them is just like the equivalent of just like a streaming device, and it's kind of just a peripheral, it's not really competing with anything.
But it can't be because you can't take it with you in the car. You can't go on an airplane and stream your console because you
have to use Wi-Fi.
Well, no, but I'm saying. I'm saying if all it's doing is streaming whatever's on the screen on the console.
Yeah, I don't think that's all it would be able to do, just to be clear. Yeah. I think that might be a feature that they could support, and that would let you play games that are exclusive to the console, you know, that like take more power or whatever. I think that would be a way to play those games even when you're out and about. But I think a lot of the games, maybe most of the games, would be playable on either.
I think that's probably the case, because there is going to be inevitably a sort of Japan-centric nature to this, and mm-hmm. of course, you know, that is dominated by the portable market. So, you know, the autonomous portable consoles.
So then you don't think that there's going to be a follow-up to the 3DS then?
I think the NX is the follow-up to both the Wii U and the 3DS.
The time is coming for the 3DS. I mean, it's been a long time now. It's coming up on 5 years.
I view it as in there is an NX that is a follow-up to the Wii U, and there is an NX that is a follow-up to the 3DS.
Yeah, well, as devices, yeah, but there's a platform that is essentially the successor to both. Yeah.
It's become very clear
that Nintendo cannot afford to make games to support two completely distinct platform simultaneously.
No, but they can have elements of library that aren't distinct. Like I would imagine that they're not going to say, well, we can only make the next Zelda game power as enough that can be run on the handheld device. They're going to want to do blow the doors off Zelda games.
Right. But there have to be novel ways of achieving scalability here. And that's kind of what I'm
I'm still not convinced. I mean, I know all this talk about industry leading chips and all that, but the Japanese market has not shown much regard for, let's make a Zelda game that's ridiculously technically proficient and then they'll lap it up. I
will say the two Xenoblade games have been technically, any game that's running an engine that Monolith Soft created, which is a lot of games at this point, and more to come, have been very technically proficient, with the exception of Project Cross Zone.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see. It'll be interesting to see kind of as a company, this will kind of be a litmus test in terms of how much they still cater solely or mostly to Japan. How much they address the Western market, because the Western market is huge, but the Western market likes those console games.
I'm sure it's going to have some TV feature that us North Americans crave. Don't worry.
Well, yeah, I mean,
Reggie
is going to
be unstaged and TV too.
Look, remember, at one point I live broadcast on this show TV. That's how good of a product it is. That I would tear myself away from this show so I could tell you about who was winning a football game
to troll
on a 30-second delay from TV.
I mean, you wanted to live troll it during the show. That's why.
No, I mean, I think the whole point of having a unified platform is it makes it easier to appeal to Japan and America and Europe and everywhere else at the same time.
Yes,
I mean, that is a big thing. But I still feel like it's not going to be a part of that process. I feel like it's going to make it less likely that you're going to have these games that they're going to make that are just going to really like push the hardware so far that it's going to be on only the premium end of the device spectrum, if that's how it's set up. I just don't know that that's the way that Nintendo does things. It would be completely out of the blue. I'm not even so much just a Western Eastern kind of dichotomy thing. I'm just not sure that's really part of their ethos at this point. But I don't know. The whole issue of how powerful it's going to be is interesting to me. I mean, because as we know, I mean, the Wii U kind of had a bit of a millstone around its neck with the cost of the gamepad. So I mean, with this situation, it's like, well, if there was a kind of portable module, you know, would that be optional or not?
Yeah,
you know, how much does that add to the cost? Like, I mean, if we're talking about genuinely cutting edge tech and a portable module, isn't that really expensive at a time when PS4, having established a very healthy lead, is actually cutting the price seemingly just to step on everyone's throat? it's not the most inviting market conditions out. So, you know, in terms of like, maybe you feel like there's something, the 3DS is ready to be replaced in Japan. I feel like, you know, obviously it's not exactly a vibrant market, but I think it's a sustainable one, at least for the time being. For a good few years yet. You know, it might be a bit of a niche at this point because of mobile gaming, but I think it's still a profitable one. But I mean, it's just killer competition right now elsewhere in the world.
Well, so I think that's the one reason why they would need to have the more powerful console, because if as long as they can convince third parties to put games on their system, which has always been a hard sell for them, but in some cases it's self-inflicted, in some cases it's not. You know, there was always the, well, we don't want to put it on there because people buy those systems for Nintendo games.
It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that they have to find a way to break out of, and they've got to have a really compelling argument for why this won't be just more of the same.
It's equilibrium position at this point that's persisted for a good while, and you need really decisive, you know, sort of course-breaking kind of interventions to change it, and I'm not all that confident that they've got that sort of stuff up their sleeves, you know.
So the one generation where you can look at and say, well, why didn't it work there? Is the GameCube one.
Mm-hmm.
They had the number two platform in terms of console sales. They had
In power, they were
right in between the Xbox and PS2. Yeah. They discussed making the thing easy to develop for, but that disc is one thing they shot themselves in the foot on. And
I think the disc had a lot to do with it. I think it had more to do the GameCube's, you know, failure to gather a lot of third party stuff. I think had a lot to do with the fact that it was the first time there were really three competitive consoles at the same time.
But that's just it did have a lot of third party stuff in the early going. Mm-hmm. I mean, remember True Crimes LA came out on the freaking GameCube. I mean, like. That was like this is a GTA knockoff running on.
In some ways, it had, you know, obviously because of the power thing. This is, you know, but I mean, it had better third party support than the Wii, which is one of the best selling consoles ever.
Right.
So I mean, it's that shows you something about power parity. You know,
there were issues. There were issues in that platform that made it less approachable to devs than it could have been.
Sure. Like there was the smaller disc size. There was the fact that, like, did you need? Basically, if you had Madden on GameCube, it would fill up the entire memory card.
The basic memory card, the 59 one, yeah.
Yeah, and the fact that it wasn't really online and all that stuff, it all added up to...
Funky controller.
Yeah, so all that added up to a system that developers did not really want to develop for.
Well, and to a certain extent, the self-fulfilling prophecy of they... people buy these for the first party games does hold some sway. So
I think that's the point. It's become, you know, it's been so long now since, you know, the Super Nintendo era, to some extent, if you're talking about home devices, that you had really diverse and robust sort of third party support that, you know, that's all the habits we've fallen into. You know, I mean, even without thinking about it for a lot of people, I don't know, maybe there's some people out there destroyingly like, yeah, you know, I only like Nintendo games. I'm proud to mostly play Nintendo games or something. But for a lot of people, it's probably just an organic pattern that they've fallen into, you know, because of the environments that they've been in, if they've been primarily Nintendo console gamer.
And Nintendo can go back to what they did during the GameCube era in an attempt to try to boost interest. And they've done it now with these Nindie games where they are very active in attempting to promote these games, or in the case of the GameCube where they're sticking Mario in NBA Street.
That's right. That happened.
I mean, it's not that they won't buy, because remember, Soul Calibur's best-selling copy is the GameCube, Soul Calibur 2.
And then, of course, Sony, you know, just put their foot down with
said, no, we're going to buy it, and we're going to make the worst Soul Calibur yet. Congratulations, you did. Soul Calibur 3 is not good.
Yep. I want to go back to something that Greg said a few minutes ago, which is that, you know, if you, this home console and a mobile unit together could be very expensive, and I agree. I think, you know, if this is the way that they go, that they have these kind of family of systems that are all sort of cross compatible with each other, I think if you end up buying one of each, there might even be multiple, you know, mobile units like we talked about. But if you buy one of each, yeah, the total cost would be more than you know, any of the current systems, but you're getting two systems. And I think the push from Nintendo would be buy the one that you want. Like, they don't expect you to buy all of them. They don't expect you to have one of each. You could, and the crazies like us probably will.
Yeah,
but
the
most people
can buy as many as they like. But
the idea would be that you can pick whichever one appeals to you most, and you're not giving up on a bunch of games. You know,
exactly.
Like, you can play
the games wherever you
want. If you want to play them at home on your TV, buy the console. If you want to play them out in the car or on a plane, buy the handheld. And if you want to be a multi-platform gamer, I think this could be very appealing for some people who are like, you know, people, they have a PS4, they have an Xbox One, they're like, you know, there are sometimes Nintendo games I would like to play, but I don't want to have a whole other console sitting under my TV, $300, just to play two or three games. But if I could buy a $150 or $200 mobile unit and play all the games that are coming out for the console, but play them on that mobile unit, then now I can play those, and that becomes like a distinct time of use. You know, like playing those games on my handheld is no longer competing with playing my PlayStation games on my TV.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. That's the point where I was getting to, is the fact that I cannot imagine a part where, you know, if anything, the Wii U experience should have told them that I think it would be a bad idea if it was a sort of mandatory pairing of one console unit and a portable sort of appendix. I think that would drive up costs and be a problem. What you need is to give people those choices. Yeah. I think, because I think we've seen it at this point. The differences in the markets, the differences in developing the games, there are all these sort of barriers that just keep people from buying as many Nintendo games as they might do, you know. And I think it's overdue for some of these barriers to come down. And certainly the whole device specificity thing of the games, like with the 3DS and how much of a pain it is to transfer it over, and all of that stuff has needed to come to an end for a while. And hopefully that is, you know, where we're going. And you know, I think it might even make people more likely to buy, you know, goodness knows how many revisions of these different devices, if it's so easy to play your entire game library on any of them without repurchasing and all that stuff.
Right. Yeah, well, I still think there will be unique games just for the portable device.
I think there has to be for both. I think they need to make – they may say go buy the one you want, but they want you to buy both. Like, yeah, there is an economic imperative for them to sell you both devices.
Now, sure. I could see you being able to have unique games on the portable, but also being able to stream the console games to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then at the same time, games for the console that maybe the portable can't handle. That just can't handle this game.
Yeah, I kind of agree, but I think if it's going to skew one way, I would assume it would skew more towards the portable because of that sort of Japan-centric situation.
I would imagine,
that the 3DS is the leading platform in that country. You know, if we consider the NX or one component of the NX to be the successor to that, that's the kind of throne it's going to be taking up. You know, and so that's a big thing to forfeit. If you suddenly decided to more chase the console end.
Here's an example of a game that would totally work as a portable, that as a console game is kind of iffy, which is Link Between Worlds. Not Link Between Worlds, that game's terrible. Triforce Heroes.
Whoa, buddy. Whoa.
Yes! Nice.
We get Johnny back and Salty James reemerges from his cave. Yeah.
I have never said anything but bad things about that game.
I mean, it's not terrible, it's just incredibly mediocre. But
it's staggeringly mediocre.
Anyways.
So you prefer Triforce Heroes, a game that you have not actually played and by most accounts is not as good as Link Between Worlds.
I'm not saying it's a good game. My point is how it's structured. It's structured primarily based around the idea of people sitting around and playing it on their own screens together. You can play it online, but all you have to communicate with is Link pumping his pom-poms and showing you an icon of him throwing a ghost. So it's clearly more based around the idea of, you know, back in the days, people would go to McDonald's and order in Japan, order the giant pack of fries that was like 800 fries, and they would sit there and play PSP Monster Hunter.
Yeah, exactly. Monster Hunter multiplayer. I mean, that is a huge thing there that we, mm-hmm. you know, that we elsewhere in the world don't really get.
And that these might be games that you could play on the home console, but you would probably be playing by yourself in that case, and so they'd be less appealing. And I'll give you another example of a kind of game that that may be somewhat exclusive to the handheld version of the NX, which would be something that's primarily touchscreen enabled. Because I would guess that the home console, in order to keep costs down and for simplification and everything else, could very well have a controller that doesn't have a touchscreen, because that's obviously a huge cost burden for that stuff. But so something like, let's say, Super Mario Maker, which, you know, ironically is a console only game right now, but to me, that makes a lot of sense as a handheld game for the NX that would be touchscreen enabled. And if you want to play it when you get home, you could play levels with your normal controller. But if you want to make levels on the home version, then you would have to actually use the handheld as the controller. So in that case, that would, you know, it would be sort of a handheld first game that you could play at home. You could share with other people around the living room.
Shades of that WarioWare DIY app.
sort of, but that would be built in, you know.
Yeah, that's without all the hoops you have to jump through to get that to work.
Yeah, so it's like, if you primarily are interested in playing touchscreen stuff, then you would start with the handheld, and there may be, you know, if you later added on the home console, then maybe you could play some of that stuff up on the TV, or at least project it for other people. But maybe you would have to use the handheld as the input device to play those on the TV.
I mean, the one thing that I would caution on that one is that Nintendo's two biggest home runs this year have been Mario Maker and Splatoon. Two games that leverage that gamepad very heavily.
Two things that they have in common is that they are on online. I think that's the real story here.
And then,
I mean, you've got Triforce Heroes, which obviously is, I think,
the best Zelda game on 3DS.
They seem to be better than Majora's Mask Ocarina of Time.
The best Zelda game on 3DS.
I thought you liked Majora's Mask, Jeff.
Best Zelda game. You know, I'm just going to be obstinate now.
That was my point. I would say that, you know, the fact that they seem to be embracing the games that really, you know, online makes them sing is great. You know, I mean, they're not where we want them to be in terms of, you know, there's some of these voice chat issues and some of these silly restrictions joining games. I mean, again, a unified platform, unified account, maybe they'll make some of those things easier. Maybe DNA's expertise. I don't know. We all hope they will improve. We expect they'll improve.
They have been improving stuff.
They're improving at an increasing rate.
But I think the key thing is we at least seem to have crossed a point where, you know, they're sort of accepting enough of the importance of online interaction that you've got games which are, you know, that's their primary sort of delivery system, really. You know, I mean, Splatoon with its online battles, Mario Maker, its online level sharing. I mean, that there is no game there. It's not some ancillary feature. You know, it's the heart and soul of the game.
Kart 8 before that is.
Yeah.
Mostly getting played as an online game.
You've got your traditional.
For the first time in the series.
You've got your traditional cup stuff in there, but I mean, of all the many, many hours I've played, obviously the cup stuff was just this little bit at the start, and then I went back when they did 200cc. You know, and then all the other hours are playing online. I think it's interesting that the focus seemed to shift in terms of, you know, the battle mode is transparently half-baked. And that is something that is a huge hit with people playing in the same room. If you go back to previous Mario Kart. But it didn't really seem to be much of a priority this time. Mm. I mean, you could blame the fact that they're just trying to get the games out as fast as they could, because the Wii U's in a bad way.
Yeah.
But, it's interesting that feature was one that is so tied to the fun of people gathering around together, which was, you know, a big part of the N64, GameCube and Wii's central appeal. That was kind of sacrificed a little bit. I think it's like Mario Kart 8. I don't think the online is as integral to the experience as it is in Mario Maker and Splatoon.
Right,
but it's getting there. You know,
I mean, if you're not online in Mario Maker, all you have is an app that tells you what time it is or what day of the week it is. In Splatoon, all you have is an everlasting tomb to the last time you managed to get it online.
No, and I mean that local mode that's in there, that versus mode, is nothing. I mean, it's not that great.
It is a communion wafer. It is a flavorful disc of nothing.
Yeah, but NX, guys.
NX, yeah. I mean, so to me though, I do wonder if seeing these games that are so you know, have been very successful for them if they think, okay, well, we have to be able to make sure you can play Mario Maker. Like, that is A1 because this thing has made bank for us. Like, cause to me, let's put it this way. NX will be targeting a lot of people who never owned a Wii U.
Oh yeah, oh, and yeah. That's the one. So sort of the principal virtue, in a way, of the Wii U is that
right. Pretty much, yeah.
It's left a lot of good games that people have not yet had the joy of playing due to its small install base.
To me, NX needs to launch with Mario Maker that can use the Wii U created Mario Maker stages and vice versa.
That'd be nice
because you would go into Mario Maker without the shit that we went into, and it's like, oh, every level is springs. You would go into a fully developed Mario Maker ecosystem. People who had the Wii U one wouldn't feel slighted because they would suddenly have a new influx of Mario Maker stages. They could actually play. It would be a tremendous boon for that game because suddenly more people could get it. Although it's sold, like I said, it's sold a lot of copies. I don't remember.
No, it's doing well, but the fact of the matter is it's on the Wii U. There are certain restrictions.
There's a ceiling.
There's a ceiling there that, for instance, even games on the 3DS would have a significantly higher capacity to sell than that.
Right.
So.
I'm trying to remember. I was trying to look up the number, but regardless, it's a really like I said, there's this kind of success criteria that they could set for themselves of, okay, well, we have Smash, Smash 8. Like, Smash 8 didn't come out that long ago. We could put that
Smash
out
8?
Smash 8, sorry. God damn it.
It's an amalgam of Mario Kart 8
Smash,
and Smash 4.
We have Smash, and then we have Mario Kart that should not be numbered. Mario Kart that should not be numbered 2. But, like, they could certainly release Smash on either version of it with just the DLC already. Or maybe
no,
not.
I mean,
buy that crap.
I think what's interesting, though, is that, you know, kind of how people are looking at some of the games that are currently coming out. And, you know, to Johnny's point, going way back now about, you know, how soon could this be coming? You know, there's a feeling about some of the games that have been coming out about, you know, we're looking at games that are spin-offs. You know, it seems like they've basically decided it's a waste of time to put an Animal Crossing on Wii U. Because it's not going to do the sort of business that it.
Are
quote,
you implying
unquote,
that Amiibo
should.
Festival doesn't
so
qualify?
We get, you know, so they still sort of fill their quota for Animal Crossing products coming out this year,
jeez.
But it's two Animal Crossing spin-offs, one on the console, one on the portable, when they haven't really done that before with that franchise, which is it kind of mind-blowing when you think how ridiculously popular it is.
Well,
in
but
Japan,
you think
especially.
The 3DS one came out a little bit late for
relatively
recently.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, the point being that, you know, it does seem like, you know, you've got games like, you know, Mario Tennis, Star Fox, Xenoblade Chronicles, all, none of these are like their core internal teams that are working on these that are coming out in the next few months. You've got a Zelda multiplayer spin-off, all this kind of, I mean, it's just, it feels like maybe, you know, they have moved on, to making, you know, the kind of original, stuff that might be for the next platform, but
oh yeah, I mean, do any of us expect to see a Retro Studios game on Wii U at this point?
No, absolutely. No, I think we all again, like Federation Force was the other example I was going to point to. Is just like, well, it looks like we're not getting it exists, James. Deal with it.
My problem that it exists.
Yeah, I know it isn't, but you still made a noise.
I just have to read the emails we get. Okay,
I can't wait for it.
The point being that you know, it just seems like okay. The Retro aren't going to deliver a Metroid product or a product that would appeal to a similar audience on this, so we kind of got this other, let's do this other thing with it. And, you know, just these spin-offs and, you know, things that will just kind of keep the release schedule tipping along without being big investments. It feels like they've moved on. Already, but also I kind of feel like, as we've seen with the other the new systems, PlayStation 4, Xbox One, you probably will have a raft of games that are up ports and all that kind of stuff as well. I mean, that it could be a bit of an awkward transit. We might be clamoring a little bit for the really meaty original stuff for a little while, yeah, because it seems like, you know, you're not going to get that on the current systems, and then when the new platform comes in, you'll probably have a, you know, your typical kind of launch blues with that. But that's where, you know, Zelda getting bumped to it could come in.
They'll throw a bone to the Wii U fans who've already played all that stuff. But
you mean like a Twilight Princess HD flavored bone?
No, I meant like an actual like new game that hasn't been on that you've never played before, but like there may not be as much of it, but I agree with you. I think there will be a lot of up ports, or I don't really see it as having like strict backwards compatibility with Wii U, but I think they will ensure that they can relatively easy bring some of these popular desirable Wii U games forward to a system that people are more likely to actually buy and own and buy these games for. But you know, it's like when I was a kid and summer reruns would come on every year and the advertisements would always say, if you haven't seen it yet, it's new to you. And that's gonna be like the marketing slogan for the NX library.
There's a lot of people who haven't seen Bayonetta 2. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Almost everyone has not seen Bayonetta.
Almost everyone alive right now has not played Bayonetta 2.
That's right.
Yeah, I hope you heard last week.
It's on the list. I listen every week.
Guillaume made me feel like a hero. So
you had nothing to do with it. I had the game pre-ordered.
Yeah.
What role do you think you played?
He apparently urged you to play it more during the games of the year thing. So.
Well, it was on my shelf. Of course I was going to play it more. Anyway, this is a podcast that has John on it, so that's not a given.
You make it sound like having it on your shelf with this crew means a goddamn thing.
Exactly.
Guillaume, when you were jump kicking through the sand, it was James who was carrying you. That's pretty strained.
Is it jump kicking when you're using your hair suit? I'm not sure.
Right.
Regardless, we've gotten silly, so it's time to go ahead and wrap up episode 450.
Forward looking instead of backward looking for once. There you go.
Yeah, it's a nice change. When we had the opportunity, it was the 30th anniversary of the NES. We said no. We said nay. Everyone has done that. We shall be different. Also, I forgot.
Also, we talk about the NES like every 2 weeks, so
we do.
It's not like this is our one chance to talk about the NES.
Once we get to my month of Rare Replay NES games, when will
I get to talk about Famicom Disk System games? All right, so.
Yeah, you did that.
I want to thank Johnny for being here this week.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me back. It was a lot of fun.
It was fun. It was a good time. It was fun. I want to thank John, Greg, for every week for being here. I want to especially thank Guillaume for the work he puts in editing this show.
Hear, hear.
Yeah. Extra long episodes every now and then.
We're still close to the, my target, a little bit over 2 hours, but I got to wrap it up quick to make sure we stay there. I want to do a really, really quick plug. Last week we announced kind of in the article and on social media and stuff that we're soliciting a new icon for the show. I kind of wanted to give a quick, you know, some background here while we're doing that. Basically, right now, our icon is old, which is why we get a new one, but it's also not big enough to meet iTunes minimum requirements, so we don't get to be on the iTunes featured list of podcasts, like if you search a gaming topic podcast. They won't even show us because our icon's not the right size, and we figured, you know, now it's time to really change it up. You know, we've changed it to music a bunch of times, we've changed seasons, but we haven't changed the icon God knows how long. So, we're asking you to submit to us your icon designs. We've already gotten a couple really, really good ones.
Oh, yeah.
A few really, really good ones.
There's some really great ones out there already.
One truly haunting one. So just as a brief primer, minimum requirements for iTunes is 1800 by 1800. We're going for 2000 by 2000, but we want it to be scalable because Nintendo World Report doesn't need anything remotely close to that size. So
yeah, if you do it in vector graphics, then it'll just be whatever.
It's easy enough.
It's like the NX. It goes to whatever size you want.
Thank you, Johnny. You could send that to our mailbag. Also, we need email. We need your email. We've got email in the bag, but we need some more ones, maybe some more topical stuff, because some stuff ages and it's not necessarily good email anymore. And it's not because we don't like your email. It's because there's only so many emails we can do in an episode. But it doesn't mean we don't want more. So send your icon suggestions, your music suggestions for end music. You could send that to us as well. And your questions to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Johnny, do you have anything you wanted to plug?
I do. So I think most people know, but some people might not, that I'm still podcasting regularly, not as often as this show, but regularly on Crosstalk. So I'm on a movie show called Box Office Poison, and this is a really good time of year. There's a lot of good movies coming out. We just talked about The Martian and a bunch of other stuff. So I would definitely recommend you check that out. And I was recently on a special for me, because it's the only one I'm going to be on probably, but But I was on episode 2 of a podcast called Digital Rights. That's with a W, Digital Rights. It's about writing for digital media, including the internet and also ebooks and video games. And that's hosted by friend of the show, Josh Hillier, who's been on RFN a couple times. He was a former co-host of Back in My Play, the good dude. And he interviewed me about writing for Planet GameCube and Nintendo World Report, doing this podcast. We talked about why I left the podcast in greater length and detail than I was able to on my final episode. And we also talked about my new book project, which is going to be about our website, Nintendo World Report, which I've been working on since I left the show. And we also talked about my ebook that I published about a year ago, and how you can find that. So I would really, if you want to hear me blathering for like 90 minutes about all this different kinds of stuff, I would really recommend that you go check it out. It's on iTunes, and I think you can just do a Google search or something, but it's Digital Rights with a W. And I thought that went really well, and it'll fill you in on some of the stuff that I've been doing. And like I said, it gives me a chance to explain myself a little bit better about why I left the podcast and what I'm doing with my time since then. But I am working on the book. I'm making some good progress. I've done a couple of really interesting interviews with former and current staff members. I'll be doing more of those. And at some point in the future, not too far out, probably a few months still before I start rolling out the audio from those interviews. But I'm hoping to build up enough of them that I can kind of keep a steady flow, maybe like one per month up until the release of the book. So I'm going to do some to kind of build up a collection of them before I get that started. But I think people who like this podcast will really find those very, very interesting. And it'll be a really cool look into the past, and also to help you understand things like how this podcast got started and how the website got started and what the connection between the two is, and how we made a website that has now been around for over 16 years, which is a really long time for a website. And I'm hoping to focus on some of the people who, have not been on podcasts a whole lot. You know, I want to hear the stories of the people whose stories have not really been told very much. So I hope people will find that interesting. And I'm sure James will help me out and kind of get the word out once that stuff starts rolling out.
Yeah. More. Just let me know.
But I'm really excited. Getting started on the book has only reinforced my belief that it is a project worth doing, and that a lot of people are going to find it really interesting and entertaining.
Cool. Well, again, I want to thank you for being here this week.
It was my pleasure. I had a blast.
We're going to go ahead and end episode 450 with a topically appropriate music. The special course theme of the Super World. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Later,
bye. Bye-bye.